Good morning. Morning.
Morning, Chairperson.
Chair.
From Audible. Enough. Can I just acknowledge you? We have the required numbers to start with our first part of the meeting.
Morning, Chairperson. We have the required numbers. You can proceed.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Morning, honorable members, our guests, people from departments, fellow South Africans who are following deliberations of this committee from different platforms.
Recording in progress.
I will, without waste of time, just deal with the formalities so that we can officially open the meeting. Firstly, in relation to just the rules of the meeting, to remind ourselves that we are on a virtual platform, and therefore the rules of meetings on virtual platform apply as adopted by Parliament, as this is also a committee of Parliament. Just to remind all participants on the platform that at all times we should keep our mics muted and our video cameras switched off if you are not participating at the time as recognized by the chair. All those who participate will be recognized by the chair. In that case, you'll then be able to unmute your mic, as well as switching your video camera on. And if there are challenges as a result of network and so on, you'd indicate so that we allow you to continue to speak without your video switched on, just to make sure that you have no challenges of not being heard by other participants. The same would apply for those that would be joining. Please ensure at any time you join, whether you've been taken out by the system, as you rejoin, that your mic is muted so as to avoid background sounds that could distract a speaker that may be on the platform at the time. Honorable members, as you know, this would also speak to point of orders that members would want to raise, that would use the platform to raise your hand, in which case myself and the committee support will be able to assist each other in recognizing that hand, so that you are given an opportunity to speak. And of course, we are advised to avoid unnecessary points of orders that can degenerate the meeting because of the virtual platform that we use. So in that score, I take it that we'd all do this. It is also to also protect the participants that we follow these rules, because it does sometimes happen that you may be engaged on something else whilst your video is switched on, and that may distract the viewers and those that are participating in the platform. So if we keep that, that would help a great deal, honorable members and our guests. As I said, without a waste of time, I will then just do the last part on the formalities, which is apologies that have been received.
Morning, Chairperson. We have an apology for the Minister who is attending a Home Affairs Committee meeting, apology for the Deputy Minister who is attending to a family emergency, apology for the Acting DJ, Ms. Jordan Diani, who is also attending the Home Affairs meeting. We have an alternate member who apologized, Mr. Kwankwa, and that it for this meeting, Chair. And then in terms of the Google discussion, we invited the Select Committee on Public Enterprises and Communications. The committee is currently in an NCOP plenary and won't be attending today. Also in terms of that meeting, TikTok won't be attending today. The USASA chairperson indicated that they will not, she will not be here today. I think that's it, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Algera. I think those apologies, would take note of them. But it's also important to indicate that the items before the committee today are really in the main for committee members to engage with those, and that's the reason we have to probably accept the one from the minister in the department who need to attend elsewhere. Of course, we would continue to recognize the other participants, especially for the next item, once we get to that item. I'm doing this because I do see that William Bay from Media Monitoring Africa who's indicating that they are also here. But as I say, we'll do that when we head over to the next item from a facilitation point of view. Those would still be recognized. But as I said, we'll deal with the first item and then go to the second item. So the first item, as you see, would just be a briefing, which will be done in the main by the content advisor, Mr. Malika, on our side. But just as we do that, I just want to make a few opening remarks, just to officially open this meeting of the Portfolio Committee. One, that we are meeting on a day that's very important to the people of the continent, based who are in the continent as well as in the diaspora, as Africans, this being Africa Day. And I take it that it is not just to remember the formation of the African Union, which is now the AU, but it presents an opportunity for Africans to reflect on progress made in the continent since then, as well as commitments that the Africans themselves would have made in ensuring that there's freedom, there's peace in Africa, and that there's development in a way that makes Africa as a continent to play an important role in global politics, of course, using whatever resources that are in Africa for the better of humanity in the continent. I know that there will be celebrations at different areas, as I said, in the continent and in the diaspora. But what is, I think, important is that as we celebrate Africa Day, as Africans, we've also been committed in the fight against oppression and injustice. And that is why, even at an international, we would be concerned that there are still those that suffer from the same. And I think it is in this context that the support to the Palestinian people, as there are demonstrations all over, including in the country today, that these are about, in the main, international solidarity, and that solidarity has been about standing with those that are oppressed and that they finally get their freedom. And in the context of Palestine, us meeting as a communications committee, I think it's important to always remind ourselves that as we get involved in treaties internationally, this will include the ITU, that Hamas commitments made was that of helping Palestine as other countries in the world talk to spectrum release, connectivity, and so on. And this is one of the recent decisions taken in the World Radio Conference. And I think as we pledge solidarity to the Palestinians, we should still advocate for that. That central to better lives in Palestine is indeed the implementation of the ITU directive that talks to supporting Palestine as it relates to the communications, the connectivity, and the spectrum at that school. So we're meeting at an important day as a committee. And as we deliberate on the next item, surely it will still be also about that as now South Africans would be engaging with South Africa and others that will engage in the future. We should keep that at the back of our minds. That will really be the point about the continent and the international space. Honorable members, in the period of fake news and misinformation, which is what we'll also deal with in the next item, I must convey a message that at least I had confirmation directly from Honorable Fanda that she will not be part of this committee anymore. But she has directly sent this message that I convey to the committee a gratitude and appreciation for having worked with this committee. And in her view, this committee has demonstrated at all material times that it puts the interests of South Africans first, and it has not been wavering on that commitment as public representatives. But of course, she would not be with the committee as she is no longer a member of Parliament. So I had committed that I will indeed relate a message and that I also believe the same, that that's the feeling of the committee, that in the way we discharge our work, it's always been about putting the interest of our people and the country first before our political orientations and parties that we represent. So I just thought I should speak to this as I committed that I will relate the message. Thanks for that, honorable members. As I said, with this meeting having been officially opened, I would now check if Mr. Malika is ready to just make a quick presentation on the first item. After concluding that item, we'll then move to the next item of roundtable discussion. Thank you. Thank you, Honorable Mackenzie. I now see your message. Thank you. Honorable Mr. Malika.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Damas. I am ready. Hajira, if you can please light the presentation. Honorable Chair, I will try not to take too much time on this matter, but only just to give a background that there was a letter that was received to refer to the committee on 26th of March in 2020 from the President, and that requested that the National Assembly consider the draft notice of determination of salaries and allowances of councillors for ICASA. I'm sure the members would recall that. Next slide, please. I'm sure members will recall that then on 8th July, the committee then received a briefing from the department. And among other things mentioned was that they were not going to approve the merge for the ICASA councillors on the basis of the performance agreements not being entered to, but also taking into consideration that there was a budget cuts from National Treasury and that the financial position for ICASA was quite dire. And of course, the country was facing serious economic challenges, including that of the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. The next slide, please. Chairperson, the other issue that they really raised was that they do agree with the president that the adjustment for ICASA councillor would be at a salary freeze of 0% for the chairperson and other councillors. And so after following that, we then, as a committee, had a report drafted for National Assembly. I think it was dated 8th July, Chair, but my colleagues will confirm if the date is wrong, but I know that it went through to National Assembly for the purpose. So next slide, please. So in essence, Chairperson, here I just extrapolated from the Amendment Act for 2014, which dealt with the determination of remuneration of office bearers for ICASA. And I'm sure the department did take us into detail about this particular part of the amendment to the legislation, which I won't delve into. Can we go to the next slide? I just wanted to highlight just a few of those, which then talk to why this process comes to Parliament. And that's the highlighted part that says a notice issued, this is under Section 10, by the way, of the ICASA Act. A notice issued under subsection 1A shall be submitted to the National Assembly for approval before publication thereof. The National Assembly, by resolution, approve the notice, whether in whole or in part, or disapprove the notice. That's where we stand. Next slide, please. That's where we stand now, Honorable Chair. We received a similar notice through a letter dated 13th April of 2021. And basically, pretty much the same process. Also, again, the president recommending a 0% salary increment for the public office bearers for the financial year 2020-2021. And again, in the same process, uses the very same notice that was gazetted in August 2020 with a particular schedule, which is on the next page. And it's just the numbers of the actual salaries of the ICASA councillors. Please keep on the next slide, ma'am. No, the next slide, not that one, yes. Yeah, so this is the extra schedule that's extrapolated from that notice that was gazetted in 2020. That's it, Chairperson, from my side. I think that we will, through you, Chair, be able to set up a report to that notice. It will be a similar report like the one we did in 2020. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mavinka. Honorable members, that's the presentation from Mr. Malika for the committee to deliberate on. I will now recognize for those members who want to engage on the matter. I see Honorable Mbele, whose hand is up. If I'm leaving any member the committee support, you'd assist me in that regard. But for now, we'll give Honorable Mbele to proceed. Honorable Mbele, you are recognized.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to colleagues and everyone on the platform. Just a very short input from my side there's solid and reasonable grounds for the recommendation as received from the presidency. My only typical point is to request that the minutes for this item just record that as the DA we are reserving our rights on the voting in the House as is convention to receive corpus approval. Thank you.
Honorable Fagu, you are recognized. You can proceed. Honorable Fagu, unmute and proceed.
Can you hear me, Chair?
Yes, you're allowed now. Okay.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Greetings to yourself and to honorable members. Chair, I just want to say that hopefully that the office bearers and councillors can understand the position of government. We have been hit by COVID-19. As a country, we've been in recession. I think that as a committee, we understand that the task that the councillors have, it's difficult, but I think we need to support the proposal from the president. Thank you.
Honorable Kubeka, you are recognized. Can you proceed? I'm not sure if it's on my side, Honorable Kubeka. It seems
I'm having a serious challenge on the issue of connection. It keeps on
keeping me. You are better where you are. Proceed. You are better where you are. Proceed.
You can hear me now. But also,
it would appear that we've lost Honorable Kubeka, given the connection problems there in the village, Parliament village. But I take it that Honorable Members, of course, without a waste of time, there is a sense that the item, okay, Honorable Kubeka, back.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, please proceed. Yes.
Okay. Now, thanks, Chair. Based on the issue of the presentation, Chair, let me just join Comrade Fagu to say, indeed, we are fully much aware based on the issue of the letter, Chair. And also, as a prerogative, as the President have raised, on the side of all these office dwellers that he has mentioned as it's only on the side of ICASA, we are saying indeed we wish to give them that support, but indeed as all of us we can be convinced to say the issue of the economic recovery plan, we can see that our economy is still a challenge. We will just say
seem to have lost you completely, Honorable Kubeka. Honorable Members, I would want to suggest that we move from the item on the basis that we do agree from, if I were to take the point made by Honorable Fagu, as well as Honorable Mbele, necessarily it's not a point of rejecting the item, but recording that they reserve their right on the vote on the matter once it gets to the House. And I think we can record that as such. And that the item in that score is agreed to and we'll be able to move to the next item. Is that accurate, Honorable Members, that we move in that way?
recognizing what Honorable Mbele has also raised. Is that agreed? So that we move to the next item. Am I the one who's out now?
Yes, Chair, you can
proceed. Thank you. I thought I'd also ask Honorable Fagu Ahmed Krisan, Krisan with the bit of a problem, connection too.
You don't stay when you come into, I promise.
Okay. So Honorable Members, I think without a waste of time, we would then get to the next item. If you can just flag it again, Ajira. Yes, on the next item, as members would know, that we would have organized a roundtable discussion where we would have thought we would have other entities participating, but of course in the last minute, like we have issued the statement, we have received the withdrawals from Facebook and others having not indicated interest at this point. We are, however, looking forward at engaging those in the future, because it is in our interest to engage with sector players in the different areas that they are contributing to the sector. But for purposes of today, we must also once again express our gratitude to Google South Africa for still honoring the commitment to come before the committee. We take this quite seriously as a committee. And I want to take again this opportunity so that we also understand the facilitation that will then follow. That as this committee, we have made it our business that whilst we have formal meetings of the committee, and the law also presenting an opportunity for us to do inquiries on whatever matter that relates to the work of the portfolio, that we have taken an approach that we would want to have more of a conversation than those, so that whether it's an inquiry at the end, it must be on the basis that there's a reason to go that route. Otherwise, we have created platforms to engage on any matter. We have done this with entities that reports to the department, but we've also done it with forums that represent particular players in the sector as a way of creating that conversation. So that's what we're trying to do, even with this engagement with those that are in the social media sector and so on. So it's important to clarify this, that at no point was this meant to be an inquiry, but a conversation that we need to have. And that's why we are grateful that Google SA would be at least coming before the committee to share what they do and how they respond to what we have said is the reason for engagement, looking at the impact of misinformation or disinformation and content moderation as we look at the elections that are coming and the elections that would still be coming in 2024, that deal with these ones of local government in 2021. This would do in a way that ensures that an opportunity is also presented for South Africans to know what you are doing firstly as a way of contributing to participatory democracy in a way that as people consume or interact with the content that comes through a platform, that they can be confident that the information is legit and it helps them to make up also their minds. And that in any way possible, we are able to deal with fake news that have got a way of altering stable democracies, as we have seen elsewhere, the power of social media and other platforms. So I think that's important that in opening we should deal with that aspect. I would, of course, without a waste of time, give to the content advisor who would have been interacting with relevant people, partly to also introduce properly the facilitator, because that's always been the approach we take as the committee, that we have a facilitator outside of the committee members, so that this creates also space for the committee members to be empowered, but to also engage freely without having the task of managing the deliberations, but be active participants in that engagement. So we would give Mr. Maliga to do that, including the introduction of our guests who would be presenting at the end. So I'm sure Mr. Maliga would be ready for that. And I take it that there has been an indication of the time to the facilitator so that the presentations can also be managed, understanding that we are still dealing with some budget votes that members may want to join in the afternoon, having missed the ones in the important task that we proceed in that regard. So, Mr. Maliga, I'm sure you'd be ready to do the honors of firstly introducing the facilitator and our guests in that way, and we can then hand over to the facilitator in that regard. Not sure if I'm audible, yes. Mr. Maliga.
Yes, you are, Honorable Chair. I wasn't ready for that, Chair, because I usually let you do it, but I thought that Ms. Mwangi could be the one that introduced herself more in detail. Her name is Thabisa Mwangi, and she's a Pygmy Consulting Chair. And of course, we were referred through the, you know, stakeholders in the of the committee that thought that should be most appropriate, seeing that there was conflict of interest with our usual facilitator for the session. As for Google SH, would you want me to introduce who they are, we take?
Yes, Mr. Maliga, you can just indicate who's been able to come here so that then take it.
Yeah, I think Hajira would be in the best position, Chairperson, for that, in terms of confirmation who is presenting today.
Morning, Chairperson. We have Ms. Thabisa Faye as our moderator today. Ms. Faye will give us a short presentation. She will share immediately after this introduction. Thereafter, we have Ms. Yolanda Mlondi from Google. I've made the co-host, and she will be able to share the presentation after that, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
So thank you, Ajura. We can then hand over to the facilitator.
Good morning, Chairperson and members of the committee. Good morning also to the stakeholders, and thank you for this opportunity. As I've been introduced, I'm Tavi Safai. The Honourable Member Maleka was not incorrect in saying Tavi Samuangi, but I generally use the surname Fai in my professional vocation. I will now share my screen and just do a short presentation just to frame the discussion that we're going to have today. I just thought that it would be good for us to be able to just set the scene before our colleagues from Google unpack their discussion for this morning. I also want to thank the committee and the chairperson at this time for this really interesting discussion and really necessary discussion. I also want to thank Google for taking the time to come and present to the portfolio committee. This, I think, will be a really robust discussion. My role here is very minimal. I'm just here to facilitate the discussion. So I will just set the scene, and then after that, I'll hand over to Google to deliver their presentation. After that, I will allow the members to ask questions, which I will then facilitate with Google. I hope that's acceptable, Chairperson.
Yes, that's acceptable. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll share my screen now. I think I will put it on display mode just to allow for a better view for all members. So just by way of introduction, my name is Tabi Safai. I'm the Managing Director at Pigma Consulting. And Pigma Consulting is an ICT consulting firm that has 14 years of professional services in the industry. We're founded in South Africa, but we're based on the whole continent, and we've worked in over 20 countries on the continent. We focus on policy and regulation, as well as a host of other services that we offer. Our clients include operators, regulators, ministries, parliaments, policymakers, equipment vendors, NGOs, banks, and global development organizations. And our consultants have worked for the global development organizations, including the World Bank and the ITU. The role, I just thought that maybe we could just set out what the role of social media in civil society is. And, you know, over the years and increasingly more over the last 10 years, we've seen digital media transform how we create, maintain, and sustain information and our networks going forward. And social media has really influenced how information is sought, how information is used, and how it's disseminated. The world of social media and digital media it's fast-paced. It's a data-driven environment that's underpinned by complex algorithms. And we see that social media in society has helped build integrity. It's helped to peacefully raise awareness around topical movements of civil society, as well as its increased accountability, especially in democratic societies. However, we've also seen that, social media can influence voters in both in a positive and a negative way. We've also seen that social media can misinform the public and it can spread hate speech and so on. So we've seen, both the wins that come with social media and digital media, but we've also seen the consequences that come with this fast dissemination of and widespread dissemination of information. We've seen how, social media can mobilize voters to the polls, can educate voters, and can enable parties to reach out to their constituencies while continuing with their parliamentary obligations. So, just to frame it, to close it off, that, social media can intensify political influence while lowering the cost of disseminating information. unlike the previous or rather the older generation of how information was disseminated. Social media allows for significantly lower costs in disseminating information, and then also reduces the barriers for entry for new political activity and new politicians. Just a few stats around, you know, the influence, or rather how big social media is in South Africa. South Africa has, we have a 98% and 98% of our population has access to mobile phones. And according to the statistics, web traffic is predominantly on mobile phones. We see that 79% of the web traffic is generated off mobile phones. So people are consuming information and digital media and engaging with social media on their mobile phones. So it's a constant on-the-go, easily available tool of interaction. 38 million South Africa has 38 million internet users, and this is across aggregated across all devices. So be it laptops, computers, social mobile telephones, tablets, etc. And the three top websites that generally have the most traffic are Google, YouTube, and Facebook. And these are the consistent throughout the various means or modes of accessing the internet. South Africa has 25 million active social media users. That accounts for 41% of the population. And the three biggest audience profiles range between the ages of 18 to 24, 25 to 34, and 35 to 44. And basically, these are the highest active social media users in South Africa. And then followed closely by the age group of 13 to 17. This is particularly interesting, Chairperson, because, you know, essentially we have a very high number of active voters and active citizens who are active in just civil society and engaging with democracy quite effectively. And those are the age groups that you see represented there. But also we see that the age groups that are going to be the next generation of voters in the next year and so on are also quite heavily engaged in social media and the use of social media. So we start to see that there's early influence in these age groups before they even at the age of at the age of 18 where they can be voters. Just an outline on the legislation, and this is just a list of the various legislation that we have in the country. I think when we look at the continent, we probably have very sophisticated legislation. We've really managed to keep the international standard in adhering to certain legislation and evolving with technology and the sector. So we are guided by quite robust legislation. But in true nature of legislation and regulation, you cannot account for everything and you cannot legislate for everything. So there are still some gaps, and that's where we find amendment acts and so on. But even in that instance, we do have quite robust legislation and quite comprehensive regulation to complement that. And just to close off then, just around some thoughts around content moderation and misinformation before I hand over to our colleagues at Google. You know, there's a serious need to understand the digital value chain. And in understanding it, we only then will we know how to effectively moderate content without, you know, overstepping the fine line of breaching the promotion of freedom of speech. So it's a very fine balance, and you know, the FPB is always very adamant that they are not a censorship organization, but they are a content regulating organization. And so, you know, just that fine line of moderating content, but also ensuring that we understand the value chain so that we can mitigate for the harms that could come out of of abuse of social media and misinformation. We also need to be very mindful of the impact that this that content, social media content, and I mean, when I say social media, I also include digital media, that digital content has on economies, that it has on financial trade. Over the past week or so, we've seen the volatility in cryptocurrency sparked by a few tweets by influential people. And so we've seen how that can influence financial trade. We are well aware of how social media can influence trading flows and so on. We also need to look into the impact that digital media can have on politics. And I think in probably the last 2 or 3 years, we've had a really robust discussion around the role of social media, the role of digital media, the algorithms that inform this value chain, and their influence over politics. And we've seen some really damning documentaries come out of this, just to shed some light on the influence that politics can, that digital media can have over politics. And to a certain extent, you know, it can go as far as being almost a threat to democracy. And so we need to truly understand and internalize the impact that this digital content can have on politics and social justice. In understanding the value chain, we also need to, you know, identify how the content is moderated. You know, we have users, and I think a lot of social medias rely on user content moderators who have the ability to flag misinformation and hate speech and crimes and so on. But then we also know that, you know, digital media, or rather social media companies invest heavily in content moderators. But this is only as, it does its role, and it makes a huge impact in filtering out these the misinformation. However, more needs to be done, and more needs to be tailored to each country's specific laws and regulations. And then we also have the algorithms and artificial intelligence that do the filtering on these platforms. Hopefully we can also touch on, as we go into the discussion, you know, around misinformation, especially, I mean, we've seen this really ramp up during the COVID-19 pandemic. I think it's almost second nature for the globe to have conspiracy theories, but we really saw these intensify and sometimes, you know, to the harm of people around the COVID-19 pandemic. Recently, towards the end of 2020, South Africa and the ICT, particularly the telecoms sector, was really battling with the 5G misinformation. And we saw, you know, uprisings in Durban, we saw uprisings in Cape Town, and it really became a problem that now affected, you know, the well-being and the safety of people. I think we will generally touch on the impact of fake news on society, on children, on democracy and the economy. That's it from me, Chairperson. I will now hand over to our colleagues from Google, who will take us through the presentation that they have prepared, after which then I will come back and take questions from the members. Thanks, Chairperson. I'll hand over to Google now.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fai. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask my colleague, Ms. Yolanda Mundi, just to share her screen. And while she does that, good morning, honorable committee members and other guests. Thank you very much for inviting us here this morning. We really value this engagement. And my name is Dr. Dr. Alistair Mukwena, County Director for Hope for South Africa, and I'm joined by my two colleagues from our public policy team, that's Mr. Charles Morito and Ms. Yolanda Mlondi. So we at Google appreciate that technology is a big enabler. We can really help in enabling democracy, economic and social progress. We actually use technology to do this around the world already, and that's why we're constantly looking for ways to deploy our technology and our products to solve problems in society, in commerce, in governments, and so on. We've been working with the Department of Health since the beginning of last year on the fight against COVID. We've used our platform to disseminate helpful, useful information. We've been carrying, news on the fight against the pandemic. We've also used AI to detect fake news. And also proud to announce that we've trained about 10,000 human beings to actually track fake news and detect it. And I think since 2020, we've taken down 6 million views. We've taken out 6 million videos from YouTube that were actually spreading fake news. We're also using our community mobility report to help government plan the movement of people and their interventions around COVID. And I think you're also well familiar with the COVID exposure app, which we worked on together with Apple. We've also used our products to keep people safe and to keep them productive. I mean, during lockdown, when kids couldn't go to school, we couldn't go to work, we actually used Google products to help people carry on with their livelihoods. To date, I think we've trained about just under 400,000 learners across the continent and about 20,000 educators in 550 schools on Google education tools and products. We've trained about 6 million people in digital skills because the digital divide is a big problem in Africa. And we've helped the unemployed youth obtain IT qualifications with the likes of Coursera and so on. And when it comes to small business, we know the role of small business in economic recovery. I think small business, at the last count, contributes about 48% of the labor force. And to this score, we've helped just under 500,000 SMEs get into the online platforms. And we've helped them get websites, we've trained them on digital skills, we've also helped them access markets overseas. And I think you'd have seen recently our partnership with Department of Tourism as well as SA Tourism, where we launched a partner page for them to allow tourists around the world to actually visit our shows virtually. But today, we're here to talk about fake news and how we at Google can help around elections this year, and we're really excited to share some of the developments we've been working on. And with that, Chair, I'm going to hand over to my colleague, Ms. Yolanda Mlondi, to take us through today's presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mukwena. Hello, everybody. Hello, honorable members. And thank you so much, Chair, for affording us the opportunity to speak today about misinformation or disinformation. And thank you, Tabisa, for the introduction. And I think your introduction was really great because it provided, I guess, two perspectives on the role that technology, social media, search engines play in terms of informing citizens about critical issues, and in this case, elections. Before I go into what we do as Google specifically on mis- and disinformation, I'd like to first paint a picture in terms of what is Google's mission. And I think that's important to understand how we approach what we call information quality. So our mission as Google is to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. Now, core to this mission is to ensure that the information that we give to our users is relevant and of good quality. Good quality is important because obviously for us it's important that our users trust the information that we give them. And the relevance part is equally important because if a user is looking for information on when the elections are coming up, they need relevant information. So we are constantly thinking about how do we make our mission, relevant to the times that we are in today and specifically to elections. We also realize that technology is a powerful enabler. We realize that as a company, we have a shared responsibility in terms of the type of information that people get. Tabitha mentioned that users or citizens are influenced by the information that they receive. So we are aware of that. And that is why we believe that forums like this are so important in engaging conversations in terms of how do we make our platform better. How do we partner so that technology
not only brings out the benefits, but we also partner in tackling the challenges that may exist. Now, because of this, we have invested in what we call trust and safety measures for our users. As some of you may know, our products obviously have a lot of users going to our products, and therefore trust and safety is critical. We've invested over $1 billion year on year on content moderation. Tabitha already mentioned this. And I think this is important because it demonstrates the commitment that we have as Google when it comes to ensuring that our platform carries quality information and does not spew hate or misinformation. We've got over 20,000 team members working in the background, trying to take down content, escalating content, ensuring that content is moderated and is trusted and safe. This team of people come from different areas of the world, including South Africa and Africa. And because of this, we try and ensure that we've got diversity in terms of language. So over 40 languages are covered with this group of people. As you know, with user-generated content, and I think with the internet as a whole, English is just one language. And so it's important for us to invest to ensure that our moderators have these skills. So we really do invest in trust and safety. Now, what is our approach to information quality, which is what we would like to term it? So it's really cut out into three. So one, we value openness and accessibility. This means that we provide access to open and diverse set of information to our users. Secondly, we respect user choice. So this means that we try and ensure that there's diversity in terms of content. As Google, we are not here to push a particular agenda. What we are doing is that we are surfacing information that comes from the internet. So, you know, we ensure that our information is diverse as possible so that users have the option to choose what they want to read and listen to. And then we also build for everyone, meaning that our users are from all over the world and therefore they should have access to good quality information. Now, how do we support information quality? So before I go into that, information quality is pretty much good quality content. This is content that is authoritative, content that is accurate, content that has been verified, content that does not spew hate or misinformation. That is what we term as information quality. So then how do we support this, you know, in terms of fighting against misinformation? We've got four ways, approach, which is called the four R's. One is around remove. So we have a set of rules when it comes to our products, whether it's YouTube or search or any of our products, which are called community guidelines. And these community guidelines essentially set out what is allowed on our platform and what is not allowed. And when content goes against that, we take down that content. So for example, when you're on YouTube, you can flag content for takedown, and it will give you options. Some of the options may include hate speech or child sexual abuse material or even other, where you can actually state why you think this content is bad content. And then our moderators will look at it and take down the content or provide a response to you as to why the content stays up. The second thing that we do to support information quality is to raise high quality content and authoritative sources where it matters the most. And I think we have done this really, really sort of with intention, specifically on the COVID-19 period. But I also encourage you to search about elections and you'll see. So what I mean by this is when someone searches, for example, elections 2021 on Google search, and you can quote me on this, ideally what will pop up, not even ideally, what will pop up is, you know, the IEC website, and perhaps below there might be news articles. So you see that we really try to raise up content that is authoritative. In the COVID-19 situation, we worked very closely with the Department of Communications and GCIS on ad grants, where, you know, when someone searches coronavirus in South Africa, the top three results are all government-related content and news articles, so that citizens and users have correct information. So we really rely on this to fight against misinformation. The third element is around reduce. So we reduce the spread of potentially harmful information where we feature recommended. So this means that we would not recommend or advertise any content that might be potentially harmful. And then the last bit is around rewarding. So because we set a very high standard of quality information, we actually reward publishers and content creators, which we now call influencers, for creating good quality content. And you probably see this most in the YouTube space, where now we've got influencers who monetize their content because of good quality. So we really rely on these four, I suppose, levers when it comes to supporting information quality. I also want to stress that, you know, as much as takedown of content is important, I truly believe that, you know, good quality content being raised and elevated is sometimes super important when it comes to fighting misinformation. And that's why we are so committed to ensuring that our users get at least the first top results of good quality content. So now when it comes to elections, so how are we supporting elections around the world and in South Africa? I'm happy to share with you all that, you know, we have been walking the walk with the IEC and other partners on this call since the 2019 elections. So we have really been thinking since then, from a South Africa point of view, how we can be more intentional in terms of supporting elections in the country. So the way we approach this in three ways. One, we have a targeted campaign or effort when it comes to helping voters. The second element is around equipping campaigns. So how can the IEC or political parties or even journalists or the media use online platforms, whether to campaign or to report accurately? And then the third element is around tackling threats. So this is around cybersecurity, phishing attacks, and DDoS attacks, and I'll get into that shortly. So on the first element, in terms of helping voters, we work to ensure that all voters and stakeholders have good or equitable access to Google tools. This means that any user sitting anywhere has good, equitable access to Google tools. It's comprehensive, it's apolitical, meaning that when someone searches on Google, we do not push a particular narrative. We surface results that are relevant for that given topic that the user is searching. It's authoritative, which I've already mentioned, so we ensure that the information that the user gets, it comes from accurate sources, which actually leads me to the fact that we really sort of focus on accuracy. And of course, we work continuously to ensure that our products offer value to our users. Now, how do we help voters access authoritative information on Google search? So we do this because we obviously learned over a period of time what users normally search for when they're on Google. So normally, many Google users would search how to vote, right? Or where to vote, or where to, or how to register to vote. And so, in this slide, I just want to show quickly, I did a search yesterday, and you can do it yourself too, that we are already doing this for the upcoming election. So for example, when someone searches local elections 2021, they have the day today, which is the 27th of October. And as you see, the second result is actually from the IEC. Now, I also want to mention that under the Wednesday 27 October date, there's that little wording on the right which says feedback. Now, in cases where you find that the information is incorrect, you as a user have the power to actually feedback to us as Google, and we can correct that. We also have on this sort of search result what we call a knowledge panel, which is on the far right, so which gives a blurb about the 2021 elections. It gives an overview of what the elections are. Even when users ask, where can I vote? As you see on the right as well, the IEC, I think the top two results as well is the IEC. So we really do are intentional about this and continuously improving the way that, you know, our results come out and to ensure that they are of good quality. So that's how we help voters. Now, in terms of equipping campaigns, so we protect high-risk users from the most pervasive digital attacks by offering a suite of free tools. I think one of the things that COVID-19 has presented to us is that a lot of things are happening online now, and potentially even with the elections right now, campaigning will be happening online. And it's even that much more important for political parties, the IEC, or journalists or human rights organizations to ensure that they are safe from digital attacks. So we offer free tools, one of which is Project Shield. So this is a tool that pretty much safeguards against DDoS attacks. So DDoS is basically what happens when your website is hacked and everything is taken down. So with this free tool, your website gets free protection. And I have to state that this is privacy compliant in the sense that Google does not take your data at all. we just gave you a tool to protect the website. And then we've also got a number of tools around protecting accounts on phishing attacks, which is a political party or a journalist or news house can sign in onto these. We also support campaigns and elected officials on how they can effectively use our products to reach voters. I think earlier on I mentioned something called a knowledge panel. So for example, when you search, I don't know, President Cyril Ramaphosa, you will actually see a panel on the far right with his information, Wikipedia, books that he's written, social media accounts. And we really encourage political parties, the IEC, you know, to really claim these knowledge panels, because it allows citizens or users to get the right information directly from you. Because what this knowledge panel allows elected officials to do is to link directly to websites, to social media accounts. And again, this is important because as much as taking down content is great, and it could be good for fighting misinformation, but providing quality content, which is accurate from your mouth, is even better. So we really encourage political parties to make use of this. What we also do is we also run workshops sometimes with political parties on how to use YouTube, for example, to effectively campaign and build campaigns. And so we have designed programs, you know, to really help with the elections. And I said earlier on that we've been on this journey since the 2019 elections. We partnered with the IEC then, and again, the conversation then was around how do tech platforms play a role in combating misinformation during the elections period. So we partnered with the IEC and we trained political parties, you know, over 60 political parties came through, and we trained them on tools to identify misinformation online, how to verify information, how to build a campaign through YouTube, and even third-party tools. So we really like these partnerships because we also believe that as much as we can give tools, we can take down content, education is critical. And then on the other hand, we've also partnered with Code for Africa and SANEF, where we've trained over 250 journalists across all the 9 provinces on how to spot and combat misinformation when reporting. I think that one is also very important to call out, because sometimes it may be easy to take a social media post and put it on a news article without verifying if the information is indeed true. So we ran these workshops in partnership with SANEF and Code for Africa across all the 9 provinces. What we also did, in fact, in the 2019 elections is what we call a hotline. It's not a physical hotline, but we dedicated a person within Google to monitor the South Africa elections. So this was particularly around misinformation. So there was a direct line that we gave to the IEC, a direct contact. That is, if anyone sees misinformation on Google platforms, they can contact me or that person directly. Even with other civil society organizations like Media Monitoring Africa, where we have an open communication with them as they do the real 411. So we are really dedicated to scaling these programs even into the 2021 elections around training and, of course, opening our door to handling misinformation on our platforms. Now, the third bucket is around tackling threats. So we monitor different forms of abuse across our platforms on a 24/7 basis. As you know, YouTube is one of the platforms that has a lot of content that goes up. We've also got Google Play, where people are uploading apps. So therefore, it requires a lot of effort for us to ensure that we are on top of any abuse that occurs on our platforms. The way that we address this is through, when it comes to user-generated content, we remove apps that do not implement necessary guidelines like content moderation. So we've got a special team that looks at this. We also terminate accounts that seek to, you know, influence or mislead users. We disallow ads that make false claims or undermine trust in the democratic process. We also send warnings to users where we believe that they might be targets of account hacking, and we also remove ads that may manipulate coverage around politics, social media, all those issues related to that. So we really do try to proactively monitor these things. I think Alistair also mentioned in his opening statement that we took down content on YouTube. So for example, in 2019, we took down 30 million videos proactively. So we really do monitor any form of abuse on our platforms. We also try and protect, you know, the account of users. So we've got Google Safe Browsing that people can use. Gmail, for example, blocks 99% of phishing attacks. And, you know, apps are continuously scanned and verified every day to protect your device from any malware. And as I said in closing, I suppose, is that we will continue to partner with industry and the government leading up to the 21 elections. In fact, we had a meeting with the IEC and other partners on how we plan to support elections this year. We will continue to train political parties and election monitors in partnership with the IEC. We will continue to partner with Code for Africa to train journalists on how to fact check, as well as strengthen our capabilities around trust and safety teams to ensure that, you know, mis- and disinformation is adequately addressed on our platforms. And also important that, to this, we will continue to work closely with Real411 in events where there needs to be an escalation when it comes to instances of misinformation on our platforms. So that's all, that's our presentation in a nutshell. So we are really committed to helping voters, equipping our campaigns and tackling threats. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Over to you, Jeff. Okay.
Thanks very much, Yolanda. And also thank you to Dr. Mogona as well for opening the session on Google's presentation. I think at this moment I will let me just right. Okay. I will do that and I'll take back the control. Great. I think at this moment then I will allow an opportunity for questions. I'd like to encourage the honorable members to please feel free to ask Google any questions. I'd also like to encourage the stakeholders that are joining this conversation, the department as well as its respective stakeholders to please feel free to ask any questions. I can already see three hands, and I'll take them in the order that I've seen them. I see Honorable Cameron McKenzie, and then I see Honorable Fagu, and then Dr. Bukosi. In that order, please. I'll take that first round of hands, and then I will come back for the second round.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fay, and good morning, Chairperson, good morning, colleagues, all protocol observed. Firstly, let me really thank Google for coming here today. I think it was the only reason for not coming to Parliament and telling us about yourself is if you've got something to hide. And clearly, Google doesn't feel that they have. So thank you very much for coming. I watched a movie on the weekend called 21. And in this film, it's about this group of MIT graduates that count cards, and they go to casinos, and they do the counting, and they win millions of dollars. And one of their, an opening has opened up in this team of graduates, because one of the chaps had left, and they said, why did he leave? And he said, well, he went off to join Google. And they said, oh, okay, we understand now. So clearly that was a big thumbs up for your company and your employment practices. But I can just turn to some general questions in the beginning, if you don't mind. I notice on the William Nicol, you have a local office with Google letters rather prominently displayed. Can you tell me how many people you employ locally? Do you keep track of local advertising revenue that comes into Google? Do you declare those results in the country, and do you, beyond the usual taxes like VAT and income tax for employees and that sort of thing, do you then pay tax on the advertising revenue that you generate from this country? That's just the first question. But I'd certainly like to know how many people you employ. And give us an idea of the the diversity component of your employment, if you can. Then, secondly, in terms of privacy, have you had a look at our new FOPIA Act? Do you feel that Google's policies are in line with that Act or the principles of that Act? And if they're not, are there any other steps that you intend to take to bring them in line? And I mean, for example, let's look at Google Assistant, for example, which is, I don't use it myself, but as I understand, according to my son, it listens to you all the time. And it is always listening to what you say. That's what my son tells me. Perhaps you can confirm that or not. Then in terms of search results on Google, as you were talking during your presentation, I think it was Mr. Lomsey that was talking about it. The searching on elections 2021. Indeed, if you type in elections 21, you will get the IEC coming up at the top. But if I change my VPN to London and I type in elections 2021, I get a whole different search page, which says to me that Google is firstly using my IP address to track my location to then direct information that I'm searching for me to me specifically. Can you confirm that's correct? Does Google then use my IP address to determine my location and then start feeding information through to me? Now, just in terms of search engines, I have including my wife who's in the digital business, their big thing and their big selling offering to their clients is search engine optimization. So they say, well, no matter what goes on out there, we will do things in such a way that will make you come onto the first page or the top page of any Google search. So if I search for South African electricians and plumbers, they will make sure that I come up on that first page. That also speaks then to the issue of digital reputation management. So if there's a negative article about Cameron McKenzie and how his beard is too white, I can get lots of my family and friends to put articles in that say actually his moustache is a remarkable shade of grey. And then that will eclipse the white beard story. Is that correct? Is that possible, that degree of manipulation? And if it is, in your opinion, what sort of scale is this happening on, in terms of affecting the legitimacy or the veracity of results as you search? Then if I can just turn to your operations, in fact, let me cover another point. In terms of monitoring content, especially around elections, trying to find anybody who supported Donald Trump is like trying to find anybody who voted for apartheid. They just don't exist. They've all sort of hidden away somewhere. But, personally, whether you support Trump or not, I'm always very disturbed when leading voices, no matter who they are and no matter how hateful they are removed from platforms or censored from platforms. Because my personal belief is, if you allow even those most hateful, egregious people to stand on a platform and speak, at least then you are able to engage with their points of view, you are able to challenge their points of view, and you're able to show often how ridiculous and nonsensical they are. And hopefully in the process, convert those people or persuade those people who might otherwise, be affected by what's being said. So I found the censorship of Donald Trump, not only Twitter, not here, or Facebook, but even on YouTube, very disturbing. And I wonder if you can just give me an idea. Who makes those decisions that you would cancel somebody who 75 million people voted or 80 million people voted for? Who makes that decision that you will then pull that content? Because that seems to be a question that's around. Then, just turning to Popia for a minute, if I look at Alphabet, who, correct me if I'm wrong, is Google's holding company. The number of companies that you own include Waze, Fitbit, Google itself, YouTube. So technically, if I've linked all my devices across a Google platform, and I notice when I use Chrome, it comes up, you know, it says somehow linked to my Google identity. You can then, you know, you can track when I've left my home, how fast I walked to my car, where I drove, what restaurant I visited, what shop I went to, which, you know, even how fast I was driving, for that matter, if I'm using Google Maps. So, you know, it's a tremendous service that you offer, but your ability to track and trace individuals is almost unparalleled. And I'd appreciate a comment on that, as opposed to a question. I think Chairperson. Oh, yes, last question, please. Just in terms of China, the CCP China, does Google operate in China? How do you get around the Great Firewall of China? Is your censorship? Does the government censor your content? And let's take another country, Myanmar, for example, which at the moment is in a terrible state. Regarding that military coup and the demonstrations and the people that are dying there. Have you had any reaction from the regime in Myanmar in terms of censoring your channels and your YouTubes, just from an international perspective? I'd be very interested in those two countries, China and Myanmar. Chairperson, thank you, we much appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Honorable Cameron. I hope that Google is taking notes on these questions. Quite topical questions I that I've noted as well. I will allow for Honorable Fagu to ask if he'll give Google an opportunity to respond, just because of the nature of how detailed they are. Honorable Fagu, you may ask.
Thank you, Ms. Tabitha Fair. Thank you for your opening remarks, and thank you for the presentation from Google. It was indeed an interesting presentation that we have received from both of you. I have a few questions. First, I want to focus on the issue that you have mentioned about algorithms, the influencing of content generation for users. If you know that social media networks are using algorithms for various reasons, to what extent are you using this misinformation of alluded and harmful content? You know, in South Africa, we have a lot of civil organizations. How can we make sure that whatever they contribute will be sustaining the democratic ideals of South Africa, such as the restoration of the social fiber, as we know? Can I ask a follow-up question to say this should be the role of social media network in promoting the constitutional provision related to our democracy as a country? And content. How does your platform promote the distribution and consumption of work in your platform? I know that Ms. Yolanda mentioned this to go more in detail. And you know that as a country we've been faced by cyber security. If you look at the case of the young girl in cyberbullying, the young girl in Limpopo. So I wanted to check, what partnerships do you have with local and regional security authorities to ensure adequate enforcement of law on these platforms? And then, what are your projects that are supporting microeconomic in Africa? You know, in terms of your investment, your strategies and future outlook, what kind of projects are you aimed in macroeconomic goals? I heard that you are talking about training, and I think me personally, I don't think that is enough. I want to check then. What are you planning? And then I wanted to check also on the issue of, I know that Google has trained a lot of young people in the country. Can perhaps we get a figure? Do you have a figure that of the people that you have trained? I know at some point you had partnerships with the NYDA. And then lastly, what role does your company play in the issue of artificial intelligence and machine learning? So I just wanted to ask those questions and then I'll come back later on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Fago. I will now allow Google to respond to these questions. I think that you will be in a position to be able to respond to all these questions. Perhaps after Google's response, we can hear some supplementary inputs from, I think I saw a representative from the Film and Publications, Abongile, and I've also seen members from the department, officials from the department. So perhaps they can also supplement, especially around things of protection of children, online protection of children, and the role and the work that's been done with the ITU. I know that we've recently adopted those guidelines in the last year or so, actually. So I'll hand over now to Google to respond to those questions, and then I will then take another round of questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ms. Fai. I think I'll take some of the questions, but I'll obviously hand over to my colleagues to tackle the others, because there is quite a vast list. And thank you so much for the questions to the honourable members. So maybe let me start with the first couple of questions. So Google has been operating on the continent for probably about 15 years now. I think we've got about 150 employees across the continent. About 70 of those are in South Africa in the Bryanston office. We have a 50-50% gender split as well as race, and we actually are about to embark on a BE audit in the next month. So that's the first question. Yes, Google does pay tax. We comply with all tax laws. And then in terms of POPI compliance, maybe just a few remarks, and I'll also ask Mr. Charles Mercer to actually add to that. We've been working with the GDPR for quite a while, the General Data Protection Regulation, sort of preparing for the POPI Act. So even before the POPI Act came into force, we actually have policies around privacy and so on. And you also ask about Google's access to personal information. I think that the big keyword guiding all our actions is privacy and consent. So we make it very, very easy and very clear for users to opt in, opt out. We make it very, very clear why we gather information on them. And really, as Yolanda said earlier on, our mission at Google is to take the world's information and make it accessible and usable. So we do everything in our power to actually deploy our technology to be helpful. And I think sometimes there's a fine line between being too helpful and maybe sort of causing concern around, does Google have too much information on me? And I think it's really about, you have to read around consent. Do you opt in? Do you opt out? If you are comfortable, we have to make it easy for you to withdraw consent. So we're constantly checking for that. And then just a question around what are we doing around youth employment and supporting small and micro enterprises. Well, we've partnered with two NGOs, the Pray Child Foundation. We've also partnered with the Yes Foundation to address youth unemployment. We actually made a commitment mid last year that we're going to train 500,000 youths, to actually make them job ready. We've partnered with Coursera. We actually recently had a meeting with the Department of Communication talking about some of the initiatives we are actually embarking on to drive digital skills training. We also support micro businesses. We've done quite a bit of work with the SA tourism space to support small businesses there. And then the other question was around artificial intelligence, machine learning. There's a lot we're actually doing there. We're also part of the Institute for Intelligent Systems at UJ, which obviously looks at AI. And then we've also been talking to Department of Commerce around supporting, especially in the area of ML as well as AI. Maybe just to hand over to Mr. Charles Mercer to add a few notes, and then I think Yolanda Mwazi will also comment. Thank you.
Through the chair, thank you very much, Honorable Mackenzie and Honorable Sakho. Thank you for your questions. And as my colleagues, first of all, I'm Charles Marito. I lead government affairs and public policy here at Google. And as my colleagues mentioned earlier, we take this engagement with the committee extremely seriously because we believe that it's important that we have this dialogue. On the questions that you had, beyond the ones that my colleague, Dr. Makwena, just responded to, I just wanted to touch on Honorable Mackenzie's question regarding search engine optimization and the manipulation that can come out of that. There is actually no way to do that because one of the key things, as Yolanda mentioned, what we do is we work to raise the content that is authoritative, and also we leverage how useful the information is. And so if you were, as you mentioned, searched about the white beard and you linked into sites that do not actually have content around that, people will bounce back. And a great way to look at how this actually works in practice is to look at a video that we have on YouTube that talks about how search works. And that is a really important video that really showcases how we leverage the quality of the search, how much people are bouncing back once they search and land on a particular web page, etc. And the more that is not authoritative, that then is deprioritized. So that is the way that the search engine optimization actually works. So it's really driven by the audience in terms of the usefulness, which is one of our key elements of how we make sure that we're following through to engage with our users. You had another question regarding Trump specifically and what you termed as censorship. What we do and what we look at is making sure that the people who are on our platforms, we take the responsibility of the terms and conditions of our community very seriously. We will not have content that is against our terms and conditions. And so what we do around that particular point is make sure that if there is content that is egregious to our terms and conditions, that content is then taken down. And that is not really a matter of censorship. It really is around making sure that we are creating the best environment as possible. And as Honorable Faku mentioned, the sad case in Limpopo, we do not want situations whereby we are liable or we create a situation which can deliver cyberbullying, because that is against our community guidelines. So hopefully that answers that question regarding hate, even though you have large amounts of people who may be following that particular person. We want to ensure that we're creating an environment whereby we are not promoting or hate in any way, shape or form. And then last but not least, you had a question around how your content may, your information may be flowing from one particular device to another, as well as the IP. The answer is yes. We do use your location as a source of information to be able to deliver the most useful information to you as a consumer. However, it is really important to note that that information is completely in your control. So if you go to google.com/myaccount, you are going to see the information that we have and that we're collecting on you. And those are basically consents that you've given us. You do have the control to pause that information or change the information that you actually allow us to collect. And you completely have the authority and the control and mandate to actually completely clear out the information that we have on you. So all of that is completely within your control. And I really encourage you to look at the My Account option so that you can see that information that we may have on you, the permissions that you've given us. And if you do want to change those permissions, you definitely have the control. And it's very, very easy to actually do that. So it's not a complicated process to actually do that. Honorable Faku, you also spoke about local content. One of the things that we do at Google is we're working very hard to look at how we continue to increase local content. And when we talk about local content, we think about it in a several number of ways, including the the number of local businesses that are on the platform, on Google platform. So for instance, on Google My Business. And the reason for this is to ensure that we're continuing to promote the utility of Google platform. So for instance, if you searched for a plumber near me and the closest plumber that you get when you have a water leakage in your house is 20 miles away or 100 kilometers away, that does not really help you. So we want to make sure that we're providing the most useful content, both from content that you can read and consume, whether it's written content or video content, but also when it comes to utility content, such as businesses that are close to you or things like that. And I think that my colleague Alistair did tackle the question around local training as well as the AI question, which we, on AI, we do have the AI principles that we have worked closely to ensure we publish those. And if you go to Google's AI principles, you will be able to see what our key focus areas are. And so this, again, it's really making sure that they are useful and that they reflect the users that we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles. If I may just also add, thank you so much, honorable members, for the questions. I just wanted to stress on the cyberbullying and online safety element, and also linking to the opening, I suppose, statement from Tabisa around the age group that also engages a lot on social media, which is, I think, between ages 13 to 17. Now, at Google, we take online safety very seriously. And over and above that, we also take educating young people about social media, about accessing information and misinformation very seriously too. So we have a program called Web Rangers in partnership with Media Monitoring Africa, the Film and Publications Board, and other important stakeholders, where we actually, you know, teach young people about online safety, misinformation, cybersecurity over a 9-month long period. So I just want to share that this is work that's definitely ongoing. And because of the sad events that happened in Limpopo, it's even that much more important for us to take that seriously. In fact, we're currently embarking on a process to see how can we as Google partner with relevant departments on scaling online safety content in schools. So that's definitely work that is ongoing. The last element that I just want to touch on quickly, I heard a comment about training not being enough. And I want to agree that indeed training, you know, is not enough. There's always more that can be done. And certainly as Google, we are open to partnerships, open to hearing perspectives on gaps and what exactly, you know, should be done more. So I really encourage that we use this platform, whether or not today, but in follow-up engagements, especially leading up to these local elections, to see what more indeed can be done in partnership with some of the of you on this call and other partners. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Charles. Thanks, Yolanda. Maybe just to add two or three points, I think we also have a couple of products in the internet safety space for families. We've got Google Families, which provides parents with useful tools to help them manage kids' usage on the internet. We've got other products like Family Group as well as Family Links. So I think, yeah, maybe just do a search for Family Group, Family Link in Google Families, and you'll see some useful tools. That's the first part. The second part is to address the question around what is Google doing to aid democracy. I think through our Google Arts and Culture, we've opened our services to actually archive history. So we've been working with the Nelson Mandela Foundation to make the archives digitally available. We work with the Steve Biko Foundation. And through our change, Google.org, we're actually having conversations with Anti-Racism Network to actually work on combating racism on the internet. Thanks, Ms. White. That's it from us. Over to you, Ms. Faye.
Hajira, just check if the chair is there. I'm not sure about Ms. Faye. She might just be logged off. I don't see her.
Good day. I do see Ms. Fai still on, but I see that her mic is off. So let me just give her a message. Thank you.
Apologies for that. Sorry. I choked on water. apologies for that. I will thank you very much, Google. Thanks for those responses. I don't know if we would like to hear from the FPB around the protection of children online. Perhaps maybe I can allow them 2 minutes. Ms. Mashele?
The mic is also still
good morning.
We can't hear you, Ms. Mashele.
I'm not sure what's happening. Can you hear me now?
Yes, much better, thank you.
Okay. Can you repeat your question?
All right. No, we just thought that maybe you'd want to weigh in on the discussion around the protection of children online. Our Honorable Fagu had raised, what is Google doing around the protection of children online and cyberbullying. And Google has mentioned that they do have various options and accommodations for that, especially around Google Family and how you can protect your children and the settings that you can put in place online to allow certain restrictions. However, I thought maybe you'd want to weigh in on recent policy around protection of children online, especially as this is your mandate as the FPB.
Oh, okay. In terms of our mandate, when operators come into South Africa, there's certain requirements that we place on them in terms of the law, and one of those, the first one, which I think is universal across all the platforms, is to ensure that they have the adequate mechanisms to detect and remove child sexual abuse material. So that one is one area where there is a universal agreement, especially amongst online platforms, and there's actually multinational cooperations between hotlines and governments across the globe where we work together with law enforcement and the operators to identify and remove child sexual abuse images. And in South Africa, our legislation still refers to child pornographic material, but the global term is child sexual abuse material, and I know that Google has all those in place, and in the rare instance where we would identify, then we can engage. But I can say from our side at FPB, we've never really identified or raised issues around that. It's only on user-generated content where we would pick up such images. And the second thing that we monitor and track as the FPB is whether the platform has the necessary age-gating systems to ensure that children do not access inappropriate material. So for VOD platforms, for instance, we have arrangements with them where they apply our classification guidelines and they rate and they provide age ratings according to the classification system or the age ratings that we use in South Africa. So that's one way, but a lot of the online platforms actually have, they use various technological means to ensure that they age gate their platforms so that children then do not access certain things. So as part of the licensing agreement, we actually acknowledge and monitor those as the FPB and continuously engage with the platforms as part of the licensing agreement. And I think the third component, which we work closely with Google and other online operators on, is the education component, because you can adopt all the technological means that you want, but without educating the consumers you will always be chasing your own tail. So we invest a great deal of resources in educating consumers on what are the safety measures that are there online and how best can consumers safeguard themselves and their children online. I'm hoping I've covered everything. Thank you.
Yes, thank you very much, Ms. Mashile. I've noted the hands that are raised, and I will call on them shortly. I note that we also have Cynthia from the DCDT. Cynthia, is there anything you want to add to the discussion around protection of children online? I also note that we have Dr. Pillay from the ITU. So Cynthia or Dr. Pillay, if you could just quickly weigh in on this discussion, I think just to air out around the protection of children, especially online. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning, honorable members. As a department, we've been working tirelessly to ensure that we do address issues of child online. And as you have indicated, Chairperson, the ITU recently adopted the guidelines on protection of child online. And as a member of the ITU, the department is actually working closely with the ITU with regard to that. And those guidelines are actually focused on how children can actually employ some strategies in dealing with the risks that are associated with, interacting online. But also, they also focus on how parents can be guided in actually protecting the children when it comes to issues of online. But those guidelines are also guiding policymakers together with educators on coming up with strategies and intervention to deal with the issue of child online. And the honorable members, you also recall that as a department, we do have a chief directorate that is mainly focusing on issues of children and youth and disabilities. So we are looking to work with the platform owners in terms of how do we usefully make use of the guidelines that are produced by the ITU in order to ensure that we do really protect our children online. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cynthia. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to take the next round of questions. I note in this order, please, Dr. Vukosi from, I think, the University of Pretoria, then William Bard, then Jabu, and then we'll close off with Honourable Member Mbele in this round of questions. I'll take the next round shortly after that.
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to everybody, and also it's great to be on this committee. I'm Dr. Vukosi Marivate from the University of Pretoria, with specific interest, especially in machine learning and AI, that has to do with language on this part. Maybe carrying on also from the first set of questions, thank you also to Google for coming and doing that presentation. You did state that you have 150 employees on the African continent with 70 in South Africa. A question then that comes up, especially when it comes to the topic at hand today, how many of the 70 are in helping, directly moderating content, right? So how many are directly moderating content as opposed to being in policy, which we've had today, and some of the people who are working on the business side of Google? Connected to that question, how many, it's the same thing on the African continent. As well, though, how many of your employees on the African continent are in what we call engineering roles, right? So they're actually building the direct tools, not necessarily only what we're doing is saying we're taking tools that are developed in the US or in Europe on that, but actually building into the core of what Google is actually doing. So it's doing engineering as opposed to the policy and some of the business roles that are on there. So this question, these two questions are connected because Now, if we look back at COVID, for example, and we've had issues of misinformation and disinformation during that time, how many then, how many strikes were created during that period? Can Google take us through the process during COVID as an example of what actually went on to block misinformation on YouTube or on some of the social platforms where there's more user-generated content that might go out there? This also then connects, obviously, to the other platforms, whether it's Twitter or WhatsApp and all those things, because things that necessarily are posted on YouTube and become popular might not be directly seen and heard YouTube, but then might be spread through people sharing them through other platforms. So I think, let me just check one more thing. Yes, so I think I've asked about how many moderators we have that are in South Africa, how many engineers do we have that are in South Africa, and the same across Africa and the full African content. And in the last year, especially, let's use COVID as a use case. Can you take us through what happened when there was either clear misinformation or disinformation content that was put on the user-generated content platforms from Google, and what steps were taken, and what does it take to actually remove that content?
Thanks very much, Dr. Vukosi. We'll take a question from William Bird.
Hello, good morning. I wonder if you can hear me. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. Excellent. Can you see me now as well, I hope?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm William Bird. I run Media Monitoring Africa, and we work with Google, and with many of the other colleagues that are on this call, including the DCDT and the Forum Publications Board. And what I wanted to raise was just the importance of, is two things really, the importance of critical digital literacy skills as a key component of our digital future, not just as directly linked to combating mis and disinformation, but as an essential part. And we welcome the partnership with Google around that, and hope that can continue to deepen and expand, so that the projects that we're working on in that multi-partnership environment can really be taken to scale. And just to be clear, what that involves is it's working with children 13 to 17, where they lead the project and do a range of things that aren't only just about learning how to be safe online, but learning how to make the best and most effective use of being a digital citizen. So it's really making sure that they acquire the necessary skills of being an active digital citizen as South Africa advances in our fourth industrial revolution. The second issue is around the critical importance of mis and disinformation. Some of the comments that have already been flowing is that one of the reasons that it's really critically important, and we really welcome the contribution from Google that they'll work closely with Real411, is that as we head to elections, it's important that there's a place that the IEC has oversight of, that it regulates in line with our electoral law of South Africa, that talks about false information and what can be done about that. And that's a really important initiative. Again, it works across not just Google, but with Facebook and with TikTok and with Twitter. And that's a really important initiative that's a multi-stakeholder initiative that, again, is, I think, an important element of this. So my question to Google then comes around political advertising. If they can share with us what plans they've got around political advertising, and what information they're going to be able to share, because there will be a political advertising repository that the IEC again has oversight of, and the aim of that will be to showcase the adverts of political parties so that people can quickly see if it's a credible or real advert from a political party or not. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much, Mr. Bird. Jabu?
Thank you, Chair, and good morning to the colleagues and the honorables. My name is Dr. Jabu Mtsweni. I am from the CSIR, Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, We work very closely with the different parties that have already spoken here, particularly DCDT, the University of Pretoria, Media Matters, and others as well. And I think we're very much interested, and we've been doing some work on the misinformation, combating of misinformation, cyberbullying, and stuff like that from the Information and Cybersecurity Center. And I want to also appreciate the presentation from Google. I think the work that they are doing is very commendable. My question, though, to them, I think I just have three questions, Chair, and then I will stop there, is the issue of misinformation is obviously very complex, right? It's not just a technological issue, and it cannot be combated by just focusing on the technology or the algorithms and stuff like that. The process, obviously, of taking down the misinformation or disinformation is also a bit blurry at some point, including the understanding of what is misinformation and disinformation, and in other cases, fake news as well. So I wanted them, I know they did explain the 4R, you know, the remove, raise, reduce, and stuff like that model, but I wanted to know, how do they decide what to remove and not to remove? Because not all misinformation that is posted online, for example, may be harmful. Some of it may just be people who are ignorant, people who don't have enough information and stuff like that. If maybe they can share that process. And then question number two is more on the, again, touching on the fact that this concept is very, very complex and misinformation is spread across different channels. You know, nowadays you even find it on radio, you find it on newspapers, and you find it across different channels, not just online channels only. So I just wanted to understand how are they collaborating, especially as the doc earlier explained with COVID, for example, they're collaborating with APOL in terms of building some of the technologies. But I want to know, how are they collaborating with other platform owners, whether it's Facebook or, you know, your Twitter, including civil society, in order to keep the information, including institutions such as ourselves, the CSIR, the research institutions and universities, because our view is that you know, this part of misinformation is a multi-dimensional and a multi-stakeholder kind of like a problem. Then the last one, Chair, is more on the, I think they were speaking earlier on about some of the initiatives that they have in terms of taking down some of the false information and stuff like that. But again, touching on the point of the complexity of this matter, if Google, for example, have a solution like Google Podcast, where you still find a lot of dominant QAnon conspiracy theories who are still using Google platforms, you know, and sometimes they get blocked, but they tend to circumvent it. But QAnon, you still find them on Google Podcast, where they use voice, and sometimes they make money out of those podcasts where they sell them using Google platforms. How is Google circumventing that? And when they make this money out of the false information of these conspiracy theorists, what do they do with those revenues? And then the last part is, I would put my submission that one of the things that we need to do as the elections are coming forth is obviously thinking about the early warning, you know, detection systems, and I think the Media Matters, they've spoken about that. Google, I think they also did mention that they have some people who are in their division that can be assigned to work with the political parties or IEC, but we would like to also extend our hand to work with them, particularly in detecting this misinformation early, dealing with them, because they come also in different forms, including the issue of training, Chair, and then as well as having these misinformation awareness campaigns across the board, because I think they're important, you know, whether it's on radio or all these other platforms. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Mbuni. I then will take a question from Honorable Member Mbele.
Thank you very much, and thank you also for the presentation. Very informative and enlightening. I think just by way of an opening remark, I'd like to echo the crucial points that was made by Ms. Mlonzi. That's often the best way to counter bad arguments or misinformation or disinformation is not through, you know, blunt information censorship or blanket silencing of those arguments, but rather through better quality arguments and presenting accurate or factual information. There might be a case to be made for an exception around you know, hate speech that directly incites violence, etc. But I think as a sustainable approach in society, that's where I would stand, and that also aligns with the concern raised by Honourable Mackenzie around deplatforming. So for me, that's quite a key sort of reference point to always keep in mind. But to segue to my question, and it's really just one question, it's partly covered by questions or statements made previously, but I'm kind of connecting the dots between a couple of them. And I'll springboard from a saying that I've seen during the rounds on social media in past weeks, which goes, we used to think that ignorance or stupidity was a result of lack of access to information, but it turns out that wasn't actually the issue. And I think what that points to is the importance of critical thinking on the part of information users themselves, and perhaps more broadly, what Mr. Bird highlighted earlier as media literacy skills, so that users of any type of platform can, you know, filter, process, and make reasoned comparisons and evaluations of the various information sources and content that they access. So given that information tech companies like Google operates in what's often called the attention economy, and, you know, so they thus have an incentive really to channel information to users in a way that appeals to their biases. How does Google approach and attempt to strike a balance between, on the one hand, its stated mission of providing comprehensive, accurate, and authoritative information, as we heard earlier, but on the other hand, which is a very real dynamic, we should be wanting to optimize its commercial imperative that's underpinned by, you know, data gathering, monitoring of cyber activity, and thus being able to sell targeted advertising, with that business model, which unfortunately does lend itself to a sort of aggregate slaugherization of people with extremist views into echo chambers. You know, how do you strike that balance between, call it, the ethical mission and the commercial imperative, which is rooted in the business model? And the example I want to refer to and end off with is that if I was, say, an ardent flat earther, and I was using Google and YouTube to find articles, blogs, and videos to support my worldview, how likely is it that I would also be exposed to and I would see contrasting views that challenge my perspective and thus encourage some critical reflection? Because I think for anyone who's ever done a deep dive into what some call the YouTube rabbit hole, where you kind of just follow video after video after video, and you see the way that suggested or recommended videos to view afterwards come up on the site tab, you'd be aware of the risk of potentially stumbling into those rabbit hole type echo chambers. So if we could just get an outline and unpacking of how that balance is front and center and is maximized. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Member Mbele. If you would forgive me, colleagues from Google, I'm going to allow the chairperson to ask his question as well as Honourable Fagel, and then I will allow you to respond.
May I proceed?
Yes, you may proceed, Chairperson. Thanks.
All right. No, apologies. I had to change my gadget. I'm experiencing some problems with the other. The questions have been raised, and my apologies for that because I'm lost in between. But just on the point that relates to political parties having an opportunity to correct or relate quality content that rebuts fake news or misinformation that may be there. I just want to check, given that there are regulators, whether IC or ICASA, on how you work with them in a way that ensures that as you create such platforms, that there is no perceived bias in terms of the time that you give to each of those parties. And this is informed by an understanding that over and above political parties, you'll also have independent candidates that may also be manning their own on how you manage that aspect. I think the other, which would relate to what has been asked already at the time of reconnecting, in relation to the number of people, especially in the country, but I want to shift that to misinformation that is embedded in the understanding of the deepness of the language, especially in our case in the continent. I mean, if you take South Africa, for example, yes, you may say these are official languages, of which English has been the dominant one, the way people communicate. Sometimes when that misinformation has to happen, it will be in the depth of the language, especially those spoken by people in the different constituencies. So how are you equipped in terms of that so that you are able to pick that up quicker? And maybe the last point for now on the same point, I think for me there's also an issue about the time. It may be easy, like we are given an option as individuals to have on us, but the problem most of the time is the complaints that get raised, and what timelines do you have in order to rebut whatever misinformation would have been said? Now, in the period of political campaigning, there are timelines, but there's also like legal processes that come in which get to be resolved by other courts, of which I'm very happy that you indicated, for example, that you work with the IC, which gets to be faced with such. And that sometimes when that's still fought in court, the misinformation continues to the detriment of whatever party or individual concerned. So I'm just looking at times, if you can speak to that. When a matter has been reported in terms of your policy, how have you been effective on that? Some of us from COVID side of things, just on the two stages. At the time of the lockdown, I think there was it was very quick to deal with matters of fake news that are there or misinformation. But I think we also see as vaccine rollout is about to come in, that they would have also been about this information of people who present themselves and it doesn't. And by the time
we lose you there slightly, Chairperson.
In the election period, can you hear me now?
Slightly better. Yes, it is. Slightly
okay.
Better.
So I'm just saying in the election period, then the timelines get to be important. And I say, learning from COVID, the rollout, how people would have discredited it through fake news, presenting themselves as having authority as professionals, and then later that this is not really the point. But the time it takes to deal with us then gets to be a problem. So I just thought I should have interested
in this. We're struggling to hear the last bit of your question, but I think our colleagues from Google managed to get the gist of your questions around the misinformation, especially around legal cooperation and as well as and how this has worked out in during the times of COVID. I think I'm going to allow our Google to respond to the questions that have been asked. There are quite a few. You know, a lot came around, you know, the content moderators in South Africa and quantifying as well the engineers who play an active role in building the technology on the continent and in South Africa. And then media monitoring also asked around, you know, political advertising and the role, or rather any work that Google does around digital literacy. And I think that's a very important thing. It's one of the things I touched on in my opening remarks, just around understanding the value chain and being able to truly steep ourselves into that and be able to mitigate it once we know it very well. So just a comment, please, around the digital literacy. And then our colleague, Dr. Mutsweni from CSIR around misinformation and the complexities of misinformation. I think he raised a really important point because as Ms. Mlondzi mentioned earlier, you know, that it's not just about censorship, it's about re-education as well. So if we can get a bit of a discussion or some responses around that and collaborations as well on other platforms and with other platform owners as well as with Google that the CSIR is putting forward to you. And then lastly, Honourable Member Mbele, who mentioned about striking the balance between your commercial obligations as well as your moral obligation of providing quality information. And then lastly, we just heard now from the chairperson who was asking, you know, around the work done with regulators to manage certain biases. But, you know, he also asked a very important question around misinformation and language. You know, in South Africa, we know that we have 11 languages and how much of that misinformation can be picked up using the various languages and the variations of languages. I mean, I do know that Google has advanced algorithms and programs around learning different languages. We have Google Translate. We have a vast repository as well that we can use and we can access on Google around native languages. So perhaps we can get a response from Google. Thank you.
Thank you, Tabitha, for passing on those questions to us. And if I may, honorable members and distinguished guests, I think that a couple of the questions that have been asked actually fall together under sort of similar themes. I think the first one is around removals, and I think that was a question that came across from Dr. Jabu. It also came from Honorable Boise and Honorable Mbele. And I think that goes back to the point that Ms. Lumsey mentioned regarding supporting and driving quality information. That is something that we endeavor to do and will continue to do. And I just want to illustrate a simple point between how removals work. So a couple of key things that we do is we ensure that our algorithms are really working to drive really strong removals, especially around misinformation, around hate speech and other hateful content. And I would like to point out that over 80% of content that is actually put up that transgresses our community guidelines is actually taken down before it has a single view. And that is a really great way to illustrate that we are actually continuously working through our algorithms, the AI and machine learning, to ensure that our systems are catching as much content before it is perceived or it's received by any particular person in terms of consumption. And then secondly, as Ms. Mulanzi mentioned, we have over 20,000 people across the organization who are really working around content moderation. And touching on the question that Dr. Bukosi mentioned across specific numbers, I would like to step back a little bit and talk about how we work holistically as an organization. So as you know, Google has products that are utilized across the world. And therefore, what we are working to do is create platforms that serve our users holistically across the world. That means that we cannot be able to have people in every single country working on each single particular product. However, we want to ensure that every user's needs is actually taken into consideration. That is not only part of the ethos that we build for everyone and create accessible and useful content for everyone, which ties back to the mission statements that Ms. Mulanzi stated at the beginning of her presentation. It also illustrates the fact that we want to continuously ensure that our platforms are received across the world and specifically here in Africa. Some of the things that we've done on the continent is we currently have 4 offices across the continent. We're in South Africa. We have an office in Nigeria, in Accra, Ghana, as well as Nairobi, Kenya. And to the north, we have an office in Egypt. And what we have done is that the people within these organizations and these offices are also connecting and creating the local flavor and information that feeds back to our organizations centrally. In Accra, we have our engineering office, which is focusing on both research, AI research, and that's an engineering office for us. And we also have other engineers who are scattered across the continent. And so that is one way that we do it. But it's important to note that these engineers who are here on the continent are not working in isolation just on African solutions. And I think that that would be a mistake if we actually say that only engineers who are in Africa will work, or engineers in Africa will only work on African solutions. What we need to do, as we're continuing to promote a connected continent, especially when you take the initiatives around 4IR, and as we're talking about the African Continental Free Trade Agreement, we need to ensure that we're leveraging the connectedness of the continent to be able to deliver products that can be utilized not just here on the continent, but across the world. And I think that that is a really important point and one way that we leverage the workforce here on the continent to also create products that can be utilized across the world. The other piece I wanted to touch on is around the balance between the commercial interest and the moral interest. Honorable Mbele, I think the first thing that I want to assure you is that Google takes its moral interest paramount, and that is actually the main driver of everything that we do. Without users, we do not have a commercial business. And therefore, the number one thing that we want to do is ensure that we have user trust. And because of this particular point of user trust, that's why we make it very simple to be able to give the users the control so that they can be able to control the information that we have on them, and really manage the content that we have online about our users. So hopefully that answers that particular question. And then last but not least, I think one of the questions that I may not have touched on is around the point on political advertising. When it comes to elections, Will, we ensure that this, we categorize this as sensitive events. And when it comes to sensitive events, we take extra caution in terms of analyzing the content that's going online, especially around adverts and political adverts, and ensure that we're really taking a clear and cautious view on what goes online. And also not everything is going to be published from an advertising perspective. I hope that answers the questions that were put. I know that I sort of bundled them together, but it's with the intent to make sure that I'm not being too repetitive. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Charles. Is there anyone else from Google who'd like to make a response?
Yes, thank you so much, Tabitha. I just want to add to Charles's input, which is, and I also sort of saw a comment from Dr. Vugosi about no moderators being in South Africa. I part of what we do at Google is also working with vendors, partners, and some of these partners, as much as, you know, our central team may not be based, for example, in South Africa, but we definitely work with local partners when it comes to content moderation or even flagging content. Sorry. So, for example, we have a program called Trusted Flaggers, and the program actually onboards flaggers in South Africa to raise or flag content on our platform. And when they do raise that flag, sorry, I don't know what that means. I think I put something on my chest. When they do flag that content, we actually look at it, review it, and we sometimes consult them. And also the local teams in South Africa are also part of that process when it comes to making decisions on taking down content. So I think it's important for us to look at, as Charles said, in a holistic manner, that this is actually a collaborative effort. It's not just those 20,000 people sitting across the shore that are doing the moderation. What I also want to mention, I think it's an important point, is that as Google, as with the lot of resources that we have, the machinery, the technology, we are still grappling with dealing with misinformation and disinformation. And that's why these conversations are so important. I honestly cannot stress that enough, that it's always a moving target. I think the Honorable Member Mbele mentioned that, you know, something will be taken down and then it comes back up again. We are aware of that, and because of that, we are constantly investing in technology, in partnerships to work on these issues. So I just want to reiterate that the work that we do, we take it seriously, and we are by no means saying that we've got this covered. In fact, it's a continuous engagement and investment on our part, and hopefully, you know, this conversation here will obviously go ahead and partnerships will be struck. Thank you.
And maybe just to add one or two things, we do have a couple of engineers based in Bryanston, so that's kind of the first point. The second point is we have a couple of projects running at the moment that are looking at spreading the use of local currencies on our platforms as well as local languages. So we want to partner with the likes of Dr. Maribati around the space that he's actually working in right now in kind of propagating African language content on the internet.
Thanks very much for those responses. I truly understand Google's point and where they're coming from, because as Dr. Vuseni rightly pointed out earlier, you know, the scope of misinformation and the definition of misinformation is vast and it's complex, and it's far reaching. And you know, the expectation on purely AI is one that would find us wanting. And so we need to find a multifaceted solution towards this, one that will be able to find and pick up nuances that may not necessarily be quite as obvious as picking up on graphic violence, for example, and also be able to pick up you know, nuances that come with certain languages and especially local languages when we speak in the South African context. So I do appreciate the work that that Google is doing, and I'm also quite encouraged to see the readiness to partner with Google and to work with them on strengthening their endeavors, but also to see how much work is being done in academia as well as in research in the CSIR. It means that we are indeed riding this wave, and we are on top of things. We are not going to be overtaken by events, so to speak. I do see that there is a hand from Nelly Siwe, and then I will take Honourable Member Cameron. I also note you. So in that order, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Tabitha. Good day. Good morning to the Chair, Honourable Members, and other colleagues that are present. Thank you so much for this opportunity, and thank you to Google as well for presenting their valuable work. It's actually good to know what they're doing out there. It's very applaudable. Thank you. I just have a few questions, and some of them, of course, might just be reiterated, so excuse me for that. So one of the questions that I have is, how do you make sure that the stories removed don't make their way back in another form, right? And that sometimes you find that the content is actually recycled. I know we're currently busy with a study where we're looking to gain insights in different motivations that people usually have when they're sharing the information and the patterns that are identified in the stories as well. So
Sorry to interrupt you. I really apologize for that. Could you please introduce yourself for the benefit of the members and everyone listening? Thank you. Apologies for the interruption.
Thank you so much for this. I didn't even realize. My name is Nelisiwe Dlamini. I am also from the CSIR, working with Dr. Mtsweni and Dr. Vukosi, also recently partnered with Media Matters as well on a misinformation project. Thank you, Teresa. So the last question that I had was, I'd like to know how Google ensures productivity when it comes to the stories that are recycled, or productivity thereof, particularly since at times you find that people share stories that have been shared in other countries or that have been shared years ago. Do they have a way to actually identify patterns in this information and make sure that it doesn't make their way back? And in terms of, since they are aware that a very large number of these stories are shared on YouTube, even though they are taken down, are there ways in which they create awareness? This is basically going back to digital literacy. In order to help with the knowledge deficits when it comes to debunking misinformation. So one of the suggestions basically that I have is that, have they ever thought of using the influencers, since they already, you know, monetize their content, to actually raise awareness around the subject, particularly since we are going to the elections as well, and the fact that they have a very large footprint, particularly with the young people as well. Thank you.
Thank you, sir, for those questions. Honourable Member Cameron?
Thank you, Ms. Faye, much appreciated. Just a couple of questions. If they were covered, I do apologise for repeating perhaps. Simple old man just needs some clarity. I did ask about Google Assistant and its implications regarding our PIA legislation, Protection of Personal Information Act, and whether you've engaged with that piece of legislation and what steps you put in place, or have you put any steps in place to deal with the requirements of that act. And again, I refer to Google Assistant specifically as a tool that might be problematic. And then my second question was around Google's activities in China and in Myanmar, Are you subjected to any kind of censorship there? How do you deal with censorship around your platform? Are your products available there? Are they freely broadcast? If you can just give us some indication of that. Thank you very much. Ms. Faye, I much appreciate it. Thank you, Jen.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I think I will give Google a chance and then to respond and give us some input. And I do encourage anyone else who has any questions or inputs to please come forward. But I'll allow Google to respond on just the last round of questions.
Thank you, both Honourable McKenzie as well as Melisiwe, for your questions. Perhaps I can start off with Honourable McKenzie's questions. On the question regarding POPIA, yes, we are completely engaging on that particular piece of legislation. It is something that impacts our business, and regarding the privacy and the PII is something that we're working on, and we are also taking the step to register content information officer, which is in line with the regulations that are in the POPIA Act, and that not only affects or looks into the Google Assistant component, but actually all of our products and services that we offer in South Africa. And then regarding the question around China, yes, we do have people who work in China, but our services are not available in China. As you may know, that there is the Great Wall, Internet Wall in China, which actually restricts our services from being accessible there. So hopefully that answers your question. And then, Nelisiwe, going to your question regarding the circulation and reputation of content that may have been taken down. The way we look at this, again, sticks to the four R's, which we look at how we remove content that promotes misinformation, how we raise content that is authoritative. And regarding the authoritative content, what we do is work across the world with strong publishing companies in South Africa. More specifically, we have relationships with different publishers, including Media 24. And these are organizations which have verified content that's going up. And so we're working to raise those forms of content. We're working with organizations such as the Elections Board to raise the information that is there. We're working with other organizations, for instance, Wales organizations, to make sure that we are disseminating the authoritative information. And just to the point that I had made earlier, a lot of the content that is either misinformation or hate or other content that actually transgresses our community guidelines, over 80% of that content is actually removed before it's seen by anyone. So we also have, beyond the human capacity, we have the technological capacity, which we're working consistently to improve so that we can be able to catch as much misinformation as possible. I hope that through the chair and the moderator, that answers the questions that have just been raised. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Charles. I don't know if you touched on the use of social media influencers and so on.
Thanks, Ms. Fai. I wanted to just answer the question about Google Assistant. I think the point here is that tools like Google Assistant as well as Siri are there to help you and make life easy for you. But then the important thing is you can withdraw consent. So, you know, when you set up your account, you say yes to certain things. And if you don't want those services, turn them off. So it's actually very, very simple. And we make it very easy for users to withdraw consent at any time. And then the question on influencers, yes, we do work with them. We have quite a lot of YouTube influencers, as you can imagine. You know, these are people that are talking to millions of people daily. They're actually able to take messages and really amplify them. But, you know, there's also risk with working with those people sometimes. But yes, yeah, we actually do, and I mean, we've been training journalists in this space, so there's lots and lots of work happening. And as I said, we've trained about 6 million individuals across the continent in digital skills. So, you know, this is actually ongoing work. We work with developers across the continent to ensure that we have the right product, right languages, and so on, the correct content. And we need to have people on the continent who actually understand Africa's needs, which you know, tend to have sort of unique elements. So yeah.
Thanks very much, Alistair, on that. I 100% agree with you when it comes to, you know, the consents that are given with using Google services and I guess any platform services. And I think that's why we had quite a big outcry earlier in the year around WhatsApp's change of terms and conditions. And we saw quite a big shift in the use of WhatsApp or people, you know, starting to use alternative chat platforms. And so I think that, you know, we are becoming more and more digitally literate and paying more attention to these consents that we are handing over to platform users. And this is not only just for the platform users. It includes the applications that we download. I don't know how many of us ever check what access and what access we're granting to applications when we download them onto our phone, and because those permissions are listed when you download an application. So it's you know, it's a bit of a two-way street, and just like the provisions we have in our legislation in the POPI Act, that you know you have the right to be forgotten, but you also have the right to decline access. And you have the responsibility to read those provisions and those requests for access. So we need to also not only put the onus on platforms, but also we need to take up our role and responsibility as civil society in being digitally literate citizens and knowing how to engage with these platforms in a responsible manner and in a manner that protects our personal information and in a manner that serves us for whatever purpose we want to engage those platforms for. So I see also there's a comment there from William Bird around the digital literacy, and I appreciate that and that we need to really, you know, emphasize on leveraging the various institutions that we have in South Africa, the academic institutions and the research institutions, in educating the civil society around digital literacy and understanding the full might of the value chain. I'll take a round of questions from Mashilo Boloka from DCDT, and then I'll take a question from Honorable Fagu. Mr. Boloka, you can, and then after that, I'll take a question from Trevor. So in that order, Dr. Boloka, sorry, apologies, Dr. Boloka, Honorable Faku, and then Trevor. Thank you.
Thanks, Faye, and colleagues from Google and honorable members from Parliament. I think I just have two quick questions. The first one relates to the monetization of content, especially news content by independent news creators, because there's been a concern, and throughout the world I've seen a number of countries going towards the need for digital platforms to start paying for content by content creators, allowing them to kind of negotiate some terms on how their content can be used by platforms such as Google, because content in as much as in the public good, or news in as much as in the public good, it is also a copyrighted material. So I want to know whether Google, what is Google's take on that in Africa, so that which they do in other developed countries, they should also do it in Africa. They can't, if they are paying them in other, like Australia and UK, they should, I think, extend the same to the continent as well. Then the last one is, given that Google is now a news carrier, whether through intermediaries or so forth, whether they subscribe to any code or standards that are applied by news organization in any shape or form, and what do they do if they don't do that, so that I think their news can comply with acceptable standard or prescribed standards. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks so much, Dr. Buloka. Honorable Fagu?
Thank you. I just want to find out on the issue of research, maybe the research unit of Google, on the training they have conducted, have they done any surveys to check the impact of the training they have conducted? And then with regards to WhatsApp, I just want to understand, what is your view with regards to the ongoing data privacy controversy that is going on? I know there's been a lot of speculation about this. People have changed to other networks. So I am sorry, to other social media platforms like BPI or so, I don't know, these platforms. But I'm not BPI, man. What do you call it? Signal and other platforms. So I wanted to check, what is your view with regards to that? I just wanted to check those two questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Fakul. Trevor?
Thank you, Chair, and greetings to Honorable members and colleagues. My name is Trevor Amidwa. I'm from MISA. I'm the MISA CEO. I just have one question around digital literacy training to Google, as to how do they do it, and what are the lessons learned from what they've done. Just as an add-on, I'd like to indicate that MISA, as a digital institute of the DCDT, is charged with the responsibility to deliver digital literacy as well. So we are on the ground doing this work, and we would definitely like to partner with Google and FPB as they go out into the communities to deliver this important skill to our people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Shiva. I think I think that's a really good contribution there. I will continue to take questions. I'll Lebu and then Busisiwe Vilagazi.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Lebule Shabani. I am the Chairperson of NEMISA. Our CEO there has already provided a preamble to my question. Honorable members, good morning. My question to Google is around the any concessions that Google may have to institutions like ours. As the CEO mentioned, we are mandated to provide digital literacy to the communities in our country. This is mainly disadvantaged members of our communities, especially the youth and women. And therefore, we would like to, you know, use platforms like Google to promote our courses. We find that we have a little bit of a challenge accessing some of our potential beneficiaries. And we would like to, you know, explore an opportunity to work with Google in terms of promoting these courses and improving on the members of communities accessing and registering for our courses. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson of MEMISA. Busisiwe?
Good morning.
Ms. Vilagazi, we heard your greeting and then we were unable to hear you again. Okay, it seems like we've lost Ms. Vilagazi there. Are you back? Okay, it seems like we've lost our connect. connection with Ms. Vilakazi there. I will allow for Google to respond to some of these questions. I do note that Google have started responding to some of these questions in the chat. So please do also check the chat and their responses and some of their, and they are reaching out quite extensively to the proposed partnerships. I'll hand over now to Google to just respond to some of the questions. Thank you.
So maybe if I can just respond to points raised by Honorable Fakul. We work very closely with social partners and we've got KPIs and contracts with them to check on the impact of our initiatives. So this is an ongoing partnership, it's only one itself. We actually do that. And I think maybe the second point was around partnerships. I think the question came from me, absolutely. As we said earlier, we're quite a small team on the continent, so most of our work is done through partners to actually able to, you know, scaling of the services. So there's partners like Africa 118. So I think let's actually get together and chat about how we can actually partner in some of these initiatives. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Alistair. Is there...
Ms. Faye, thank you for the opportunity. I think that there was a couple of questions. The first one was around news content and demonetization of news content. I think that it's important to step back a little bit and talk about how Google works. So Google is a search engine that then surfaces content that people are looking for. And that is a really important thing. We as Google do not create content. We do not publish news, and we're not a news organization. However, our platform works with news publishers to surface their content. And then going back to the commercial aspect of it, it is really important to note that how Google's monetization policy works is that a majority, Google makes money through advertising, and a majority of the advertising share actually goes to the content owner. So reflecting on the point that we do not create content, and the majority of the advertising dollars actually go back to the content creator, that is how the news publishers actually make money. So when you look at the various publishers that are putting content, ads are actually served against that particular piece of content if there's a news article that is published on a particular content creator's website. Then we serve what we call an AdSense partnership, which is basically a partnership whereby we are going to serve ads to the website of that particular content creator. And then that ad that is served, the person who pays for that ad, a majority of the ad dollar actually goes to the actual content creator. Really important to talk about that. Think about it from a Yellow Pages perspective. If we can reflect back on the days beyond the internet, what we are creating is a platform which then enables various content creators to have their content found by the users. We then serve advertising on that particular piece of content, and then we share the advertising spend with a majority of that going to the content creator. So I hope that that answers the question. And I think that the other question that was asked by Honorable MP regarding some of the other platforms, I don't think that we're in a position to speak on their behalf because those are not platforms that we are engaging with. So I think we'd like to reserve the response to those particular platforms themselves.
Thank you very much, Charles, for that. I see Busisiwe Vilakazi is back. I'll give you an opportunity to speak, and then I'll allow for William Bird to speak. If I can just get an indication on the timelines, are we still good to continue?
Yes, it's fine.
All right. Thank you, Chairperson. All right.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody, again. My name is Positiva Vilakase. I am from CETA. So I have two questions. One is around, I think Dr. Vungosi touched on it, around the issue of the actual number of engineers who are local and who are developing the technologies that actually form core of Google service offering. And I think that's a very important question that I felt perhaps was not answered, because we know that diversity matters, especially when it relates to technology development, and now furthermore speaking to issues of AI and how certain groups are represented in those platforms. So I think Google needs to actually maybe clarify in terms of how many actually local South African engineers and even from the African continent are actually producing content that leads to the core service offering that they do worldwide. You know what, we're not speaking about technologies for African, we're just talking about Africans being contributors to the overall technology developed globally. And the second question also relates to that in terms of what is Google doing to support local innovators to be able to actually develop technology that leads into some of their service offering. And especially this is where it will be helping South Africa to actually in the African continent to stop being just consumers of technology, but also start playing in this ecosystem where that now we are now also becoming developers of those technologies that are consumed both in the African continent and globally. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Busisiwe. William?
Thank you. Thanks, members, again. So just a quick follow-on. One of the critical issues to hear the Google panel's response on is around programmatic advertising, and it links onto that thing around media sustainability to a degree, right, which is that one of the challenges is that credible brands often buy programmatic adverts, right? Through the Google platforms, it's a cheap, very effective way of getting your brands into different audiences, into different places. But one of the big challenges that we have with that is that very often those brands appear on sites that are very, very dodgy. So we've seen that on a number of occasions where people will set up a site, in fact, just deliberately with the intent of spreading mis- and disinformation in order to make that in order to make money from that particular exercise, and that's clearly something that runs counter to basic democratic principles. Obviously, all of those involved still make money from it, but from an ethical and rights and legal point of view, I'd be curious to hear what ways and means Google can take to challenge that particular issue around ensuring that credible brands don't appear on dodgy sites, especially when we have a list of credible sites in South Africa. Thank you.
Thank you very much, William, for that contribution. I don't see any further hands, so I'll allow Google to respond, and then I think I will then begin to wrap up the discussion in the absence of any further questions or comments.
Thank you, Ms. Taye. So starting off with Butisiwe's question, I think it's imperative to state that the engineers that we have in Accra, and we have other engineers in some of the other offices, but our biggest engineering office is in Accra, Ghana, are not just working on African solutions. They're working on solutions for Google products. And I think it's imperative for us to really make that clear. And when you think about a particular piece of article and research that we published last year, called the Africa Economy Report 2020, It actually went through on a country-by-country basis, analyzing the number of engineers, developers, and other tech experts on the continent and what their potential of the internet economy could be by 2025. And that number lies around $180 billion in terms of economic contribution to our continent. And it's along this sort of mission that we are working not only to employ engineers on the continent who are going to be providing solutions just for Africa, but really solutions that affect the world. And that is something that we're going to continue doing, because in the same vein as you talked about diversity and inclusion, that is something that we really take seriously. And if you listen to our last earnings call, whereby we talked about the number of people that we've hired and we're continuing to hire more people on the continent, one of the things that we're looking to do is make sure that diversity and inclusion is something that is not just reflected in terms of the people who work for us at Google, but also in the ethos of how we develop our products and services. We've had situations whereby we are consistently evolving and improving the search results, the algorithms, and those are very deliberate, and we're going to continue doing that so that the tools and services that we have are reflective of our users, no matter where they are, whether they're in Africa or elsewhere. So hopefully that answers your question. So in terms of a specific number, I don't think that right now that is really relevant, because it's a number that's continuing to grow. As we speak right now, we're currently hiring a director of cloud, which is an engineering role, in which is open to be based anywhere across the continent. We have a couple of other engineering roles that have just been filled within the last couple of months, some of them based in Kenya, some of them based in South Africa, and others based in Ghana. And so I think that it's an evolving and moving target, whereby the one way that we're going is that we're hiring more and more Africans to take more and more jobs. And then more importantly, I would like to point out a program that we have, which is called Launchpad Africa. And Launchpad is a program whereby we're working with startups across the continent. So far, we've had startups from 27 different African countries. And on this particular program, we're helping startups scale up and develop solutions for the continent. And we're helping them not only with grants, which we give them in terms of helping them scale the businesses that they have, but also in terms of mentorship and some of our other products, whether it's cloud hosting, etc., so that they can be able to build businesses that are not only targeted at their own countries, but are targeted to provide solutions for Africans in general, and where possible, solutions that actually scale beyond the continent. And so going back to that economy report that we published last year, I really encourage the members on this call to go to that report, and also think about another white paper that we published last year, which talks about the four key pillars that are going to be vital in terms of economic growth around the digital economy. That particular report is called the Digital Sprinters Report, and there are four key pillars of that. The first one is around the human capital. So what are we doing to help drive digital skills and really ensure that Africans have the right skill set to be able to leverage what the technical and the technology economy is going to deliver? And in South Africa, I know that 4IR is a really core and central part of President Ramaphosa's government initiative. The second piece is looking at physical infrastructure. What are we doing to drive the best physical infrastructure so that people in the most remote parts of the continent can be able to access the internet? Because even if the internet has the greatest value, if people cannot get online, they will not be able to really take part in that digital economy. So it's really important that as Africans, we're able to leapfrog where we have been from an infrastructure perspective, drive sharing of spectrum and other physical infrastructure so that both the cost of data can come down and more people can be online. And then the third piece is around the adoption of technology, especially around government, services to be able to deliver the best services to their citizens, so that we can actually drive better efficiencies around that. And then last but not least is around competition. And when we talk about competition, is ensuring that we have the right framework from a regulatory perspective so that we can be able to drive a competitive environment. I am particularly excited about the African Continental Free Trade Agreement and the 37 countries that have ratified that agreement, and looking forward to the digital protocol that is currently in process and hopefully shall be complete by early next year, so that as an African economy, which is going to be about $3.7 trillion, that marketplace, we can be able to leverage that and be able to drive the best specialization across different areas. And Busisi, we're just in closing, I think it's difficult to be able to have sort of people building for each particular country. What we need to do, especially with AFICTA coming into play, is leverage and create centers of excellence across the continent and collaborate, so that, for instance, when it comes to the automotive industry and what we're doing in South Africa, we can be able to leverage that and export some of those products across the continent. And when it comes to other elements, for instance, fintech, we can create fintech hubs, which then service the continent. So I think as we're talking today about misinformation and then opened up into a much broader conversation around the digital economy, I think we really need to think from a Pan-African perspective and see how we can be able to leverage the specialism of different regions and see how we can really grow the economy of Africa as a whole. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Charles. I can see one more hand. I'll allow Jabu to ask his question and or make his comment. And if there are any more further questions, I welcome questions. We still have some time. So I'll let Dr. Mzweni ask his question.
Thank you, Tabitha. Mine is just a brief one. I know we have covered a lot on the technical side of things, including maybe the people side, talking about training and awareness. One aspect that I just wanted to raise, and I also wanted maybe to get the comment, particularly from the platform owners such as Google, is the issue of regulations. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, and I want to emphasize again, that our view is that curbing or combating, you know, misinformation is a multifaceted problem that requires multi-stakeholders. But over and above that, I think the issue of process or legislation or something like that becomes very key. So I just wanted to get from them, and I know they've spoken a little bit about what happens in China, but within our context, African context now, do they believe that the issue of self-regulation, in other words, the platform owners being the ones that decide how to regulate the content that is taken out and shut down and stuff like that, do they see the self-regulation as the best approach, maybe just like what is happening with the media, or do they think that probably government needs to come in and put some baseline regulations in place like we have done maybe with POPEA and the cyber crimes bill now, because ultimately, as people promote this misinformation, we also know that there are criminal elements in this. You know, there are people who are, and I think maybe you mentioned earlier, there are various intentions that people have in terms of promoting misinformation or even disinformation. Some of them, which, as I said, could be innocent, such as, you know, people just throwing satire or poking fun. But in other instances, particularly during elections, you find that some of these other things could be done for profit, it could be done for political influence, for propaganda, and the misleading content could also be dangerous, you know, to the national security of the country, and so on and so forth. So I just wanted to get some input from them, and not necessarily for Google only, but just for the platform owners in terms of self-regulation and government regulation. And I think I'm raising this point as well. They have volunteered to say we would come. I don't know why the other platform owners maybe may have not wanted to participate, but they have sort of voluntarily sort of engaged us in this particular platform. So I just want to get their views on that. Thanks, Tabisa.
Thanks very much, Dr. Nzweni. Dr. Vukosi?
Thank you. And again, I also want to thank Google for their answers. I think on some point here is that we shouldn't look at each other as being adversaries in any way. I'm an academic, you're civil society, we have public sector here in government, and as well as maybe Google representing a private sector entity or organization that is working within, yes, this kind of internet economy. The questions that are being asked, especially about the engineering and the moderators being local, it's expected that the answer is going to be, hey, we're a very big company, and as such, what we're doing is we're trying to just craft a kind of local flavor that then gets communicated to the big company in Mountain View or the London office or the, you know, Zurich or wherever, and then they adjust as possible. The point in asking these is, now let's say the elections are coming along and we then end up having a lot of very specific situations to South Africa in terms of where people might be carrying out disinformation campaigns, right? So if we go back to Bell Pottinger and in South Africa specifically, in the past, which was really a shameful point, and it's continuing, we're still having situations of astroturfing that are going on in South Africa. And a platform such as YouTube, Twitter, TikTok, whichever, are being used in this way. So now, when it comes down to making those day-to-day decisions about what will be taken down, what will be kept up, who gets put into these conversations, that's when now the question of where are the local engineers, where's the local moderation team that can then engage very vigorously, whether with civil society, whether with journalists, but not as the final kind of system decisions are actually going to be made about at this other central office on that part. And that's how maybe the understanding that I think hopefully the members, especially of this parliamentary portfolio, have come to now see that this is a challenge, and it's not just a Google challenge. It will likely be the same thing that you see with Facebook. This is the same thing you'll see with Twitter. This is the same thing we'll see with TikTok, that across the African continent, or even in South Africa in particular, that the technical shaping of these technologies are not coming from here. And as such, there are limitations, even when we have these conversations, about where, how far this can actually go in changing things, maybe in the short term. In the long term, it might be that, the regulations, the conversations that we're having today, they are very important on that part, but it's very different to maybe if we put ourselves in the conversations that we had earlier in the year in the U.S., when it came to the attack on the Capitol building, that the conversation that we had with the CEOs of Facebook, of Google would be in a very different way, even then connected to misinformation and disinformation, because there's a direct line to say, here's what, our engineering, here's what our moderating policies are, especially for the American elections, and here's how it worked. In specifics, I think that question has come up in different ways by different members of what actually happens in moderation, in the moderation queue and on that part. And this really requires that now we have more localized, hey, here's our moderation team. This is what the moderation team likely looks at. This is who they would invite in talking through those challenges in a way. As I said, we are not adversaries in any way. These are questions that are coming up because at the end of the day, we're all trying to get to a common understanding of how we move forward. Thank you, Tabisa.
Thank you very much, Dr. Vukosi. I will allow Google to answer those questions. I also want to remind Charles, I think it's you who will be fielding these questions. I also wanted to remind you around, if you could please respond to William Bird's question around programmatic advertising. I think that wasn't adequately addressed in the previous round of questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Tabitha. I think I'll start with programmatic advertising piece. I think one of the key things that we do is ensure that on our AdSense product, for any advertising to be in any platform, they need to abide by our AdSense policy. And if anything sort of circumvents or transgresses our community guidelines and our AdSense policies, we actually put a ban on those particular websites and do not serve ads on those particular websites. So I hope that that answers that question from William. Dr. Bukosi, regarding your question around local participation, I think it's important to iterate the point that we do have a lot of local representation on the continent. In South Africa specifically, we have a very strong partnership with 411, whereby we flag different pieces of misinformation or hate speech or any other content that transgresses our community guidelines. And in addition to that, as Ms. Mlonzi mentioned earlier, there's a direct line that we put in place whereby we can be contacted directly to address any particular issues of misinformation, especially around elections. And as I had mentioned earlier regarding the sensitive events, notifications that we put in place, we ensure that we're doing everything that we can. But as you said, and rightfully so, we are not adversaries. We have to work together on these particular issues as academia, as civil society, as government, and as private sector. We all have a responsibility to ensure that we're working together to ensure that we have the right information online, that we are flagging and raising issues that may come up, and ensure that together we deliver the best and focus on the opportunities that the digital economy is going to provide for our countries and our continent going forward, and especially when it comes to the issue of youth unemployment, which is a big challenge across the continent for us. And then there was a question earlier from Dr. Jabu regarding self-regulation and what is the best way to look at that. And I think that goes back to my point and some of the pieces of recommendations that we make in our Digital Sprinters white paper, talking about smart regulation. I think that it has been illustrated really well in South Africa, where we've worked with various government agencies and regulators to craft and help deliver the right forms of legislation. As Google, we are completely pro-smart regulation so that we can be able to work within the countries that we're operating in. And I think that the Film and Classifications Board is one such partner whereby we've engaged with them. We really collaborate and communicate with them, whether it's on the child online safety, as has been discussed earlier, or other matters when it comes to content online, because at the end of the day, we believe that it's really critical for us to work with the regulators and ensure that we are applying both regulation that matters in country as well as for companies such as ourselves, bringing in the best practices of things that we've seen working from other places. For instance, it would be impossible to be able to manually classify every single piece of content that is on YouTube. And just to give an example, as we speak right now, we have over 500 hours of content being uploaded on YouTube every single minute. It is virtually humanly impossible to be able to classify that content if it's going to be consumed in South Africa. So what we do is ensure that both between a mix of the algorithms that we have as well as human intervention, we deliver the best services to our consumers and also rely on the community guidelines and the community trusted flaggers to be able to flag content that may actually transgress our community guidelines. With that, I hope, Tabitha, I have answered all the questions that have come up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charles. In the absence of any other questions, I don't see any other hands. I don't see any other hands, and I haven't received any other questions in the chat as well. So I think in the absence of any further input, I will then wrap up the session and hand over to the chairperson. I just wanted to thank everyone for contributing, for listening and sending your questions, making your concerns known. I think we're all we walk away richer today through partnerships, through more knowledge, through a better understanding of the value chain, but also just also understanding the gaps that remain in misinformation as well as content moderation. I think it would be an absolute we would be missing it if we did not thank Google for availing themselves today to speak to us, to share with us the work that they're doing, to share with us the partnerships that they've done, but also to avail themselves to further partnerships and to working even further and harder on content moderation in digital media and social media. So we are really grateful to you, Dr. Alistair, Charles, and Yolanda. Thank you for your time, and thank you so much for the incredible contributions and the robust discussions that we've had, and just indulging us and giving us an opportunity to peer into the operations of Google and the work that you're doing there. I think that we still have so much more to benefit. There are so many other initiatives that Google is running that we as a country and civil society as well as public sector are yet to harness fully and enjoy this with Google. So I'm very encouraged by the connections, and I've seen that Google have very openly shared their contact details. So please, if you are looking to partner with them, could you please reach out to them? And I hope that we will also be seeing a lot more partnerships from further partnerships with the FPB, and I've seen a great strides have been made by the FPB as well, especially when it comes to over the top players, and this has been a real point of contention for the regulator, for FPB as well as ICASA, around how to regulate, or rather how to moderate over the top players. And so I've seen some great integration of FPB's work into various over the top players. I've seen it on Netflix. I've seen I'm seeing it in with Google partnerships as well. So we hope that we'll see more partnerships around that, and more partnerships with CSIR and academia. With that, Chairperson, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity and thank the industry for their robust participation. I think this has been a really insightful morning for all of us, and I'll hand over back to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Fine, for the opportunity. I think I'll just use the few minutes that I have to firstly, thank the members for agreeing to have this session, as it is a committee resolution to continue engaging the sector, and that they participated actively. But secondly, I must really thank Google once again. I'm doing this on behalf of the members, and I'm sure South Africans who have been following the deliberations would have learned a lot from their presentation, the responses to questions, and willingness to engage going forward. of course, all the participants who would have made this interaction quite live in terms of what they've raised. And I think as the committee would continue to engage even the other partners that we seem to have seen on the platform who are working almost on similar issues that we are continuing to engage. Whether this will be through bilaterals or roundtable discussions with other participants, I think that's something that we'll be able to look at as the committee. But more importantly, I must really thank you, Ms. Fai, for facilitating this so well. In fact, I was just looking at all the roundtable discussions that we've had so far, that the ship has been steered by African women. And on Africa Day, I think it's important to recognize that women are taking their rightful place in society and they do this without fear or favor. And that bodes well for the future of equality in terms of gender and so on. So we would really want to appreciate that and thanks very much. Of course, I would not leave the support staff that put all this together, including from at least guidance on the content we should shape the discussions. And I think that would have been achieved. The department for all the support, including entities that we have been able to bring forward and clarify some of the questions that we need them to clarify. I think that was quite empowering. Thanks very much. Until we meet again when we have another session.
Recording started.
Thank you.
I think before you close, I can see Charles has his hand up.
Okay.
Recording in progress.
Thank you so much, Honorable Member, and thank you, Tabitha, for recognizing me. I just wanted to actually make a call out that today, in honor of Africa Day, on YouTube, we do have the Africa Day concert, which celebrates African talent, and we do have Minister Stella Abrams delivering a message on that. It starts this evening at 6 o'clock South Africa time. So I just wanted to call attention to that on YouTube. I hope that the members here and everyone else is going to enjoy that. Thank you so much again, and thank you for having us.
Thank you, Charles. As I said, we
recording stopped.
We have moved to the end of the meeting officially, and I'm sure we'll continue to enjoy Africa Day and happy Africa Day once again. Thank you.